Okay, meeting will come to order. Representative Hawes, you have a bill up? No, but we'll lay it over. Representative Lilly will move your bill, and this one, doesn't it go laid over? Representative Lilly moves that your bill be heard and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hawes, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, on whether it be laid over or sent to the House floor, I would bow to your wisdom on that, but it does look like a bill to me that could be moved to the House floor.
Representative Hawes, for now, we'll lay it over. And
thank you very much, and potential for consideration because it contains no money. Thank you very much, sir.
This is, in other words, what you're saying is probable, possible, then, in this case.
Well, it's better than some of my bills, which is possible.
Right. It's even better than possible. Probable, possible is very good.
Very good. That's a very good bill. Thank you very, very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill does not change law, but does clarify the law. The law was originally a 1943 law that I thought was pretty clear, but as time goes on, it erodes a little bit, and people are interpreting this way and that way. So we really want to put it back in order so that there is no interpretation to what that law says, that it is law and not held up to erosion. That law is clear that when you are mobilized for military service, that your state licenses and your contracts and your certificates, they're held in order for when you get back and for the next 6 months. And it specifically notes that it is true for firearms and use of force. This does not protect a person's job when they come back. It protects their license. Their job is protected under a federal law, which is called USERA, I would think. I have a witness here that is an expert, and this is also a part of the governor's bill. And
Representative Hawes, let me just ask, is there any opposition to this bill out there?
I would certainly hope not, but let us ask.
That's what I'm doing. I think that's what I was doing. I don't see any, so, sir, could you keep it very short, and I'll be asking Representative Smith whether he thinks this is a consent calendar bill, and you can think about that while he's testifying. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Eric Collins, Department of Military Affairs. And it's really interesting that this issue, as deployed service members receive more intensive training on these specific issues and practical application of these skills than most anything else. Basically, service members, when deployed, they carry their weapons with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we truly ask our soldiers to do incredible things, turning from warrior to policeman, to teacher to mediator in a matter of seconds. And their experience and success in mastering the use of force cannot be overstated. And in fact, just allow me to be a little more specific. Soldiers are working to transition to local control in all the active theaters that we're involved in at this point in time. And as part of this effort, they spend a significant amount of time serving as mediators and negotiators. And many of their roles can be likened to being a cop on a beat, where this role is to keep or to make peace within the neighborhoods. And as Representative Hawes said, that this is an item on the governor's military and veteran support package and has his full support.
Thank you. I assume that's enough testimony. Representative Smith, do you think this meets the requirements?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it does.
Would you care to move for the consent calendar then?
Mr. Chairman, so moved.
Thank you, Representative Smith. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Representative Paz, an outstandingly better reception than the last one.
I still have a little facial twitch, but I'm used to it. Thank you.
Representative Nelson, would you step up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson, I think we'll give you 4 minutes. Is that enough for...
More than enough, I hope.
Do you want 3 minutes? Is that preferable?
Anyway, do I get a bonus if I get less?
Sure.
Anyway, this is House File 1130, and if someone would like to move the bill, that'd be great.
Representative Saylor moves your bill.
Okay. Also, before we get started, I have a small verbal amendment, and this comes from the public defenders who had a concern, and so on line 110, after the comma, after misconduct, delete or an attorney.
Delete or an attorney?
Or an attorney after the comma, yes.
And anything, is
that's
that
it? That's it. And if someone would move that amendment?
Representative Saylor moves that amendment. Representative Nelson, question. There's an amendment A1. Is that yours, or is that...
That amendment was the public defenders brought forward, and they worked with the department of bringing that brought me the bill, and this was the agreement they came to. This satisfied them, the or an attorney. So you
can wait on the A1 amendment. A1, then? Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Then Representative Saylor moves the oral amendment to get in the shape the offer wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Go ahead, Representative.
And now I have Catherine. Keeping with St. Patty's Day, I have Cassandra O'Hearn here from the department to testify on the bill.
O'Hearn?
O'Hearn.
Oh, O'Hearn.
O-H-E-R-N.
Ms. O'Hearn.
With an apostrophe in it.
Okay.
Ms. O'Hearn.
Chair, committee members, my name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm with the Department of Public Safety. I'm the Director of Internal Affairs. And I know your time is very short, so I'd really like to keep this very short. The purpose is not really to expand what was currently in the law, but rather to add language to reflect the current practice out there, which is that claims against officers are often made to somebody other than a police officer, but still to a person who works under the authority of the chief law enforcement officer. And I guess I'll unless people have questions, leave it at that.
It seems clear, but are there any questions of the witness or the author? Okay, are there any speakers in opposition to this? Okay, then Representative Nelson, this bill, Representative Smith, do you think this one is or not?
I'll defer to the wisdom of the chair, Mr. Chair.
Well,
I don't have any
objection. I'm just thinking of whether this is a consent calendar item or not. It seems to be. Representative Smith, do you think it's up to you?
Mr. Chair, I have no objections to this thing going to the consent calendar.
Would somebody, Dennis said that the tradition is somebody from the other side of the aisle makes the motion.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Then the motion is to, I asked for it. Oh, there are people? Oh, I asked if there was opposition. Nobody raised their hand. Oh, I couldn't see it. Okay, I'm sorry, Representative Smith.
For the purposes of this hearing, I'll withdraw the motion.
Yes, thank you. Okay. There was three hands, was there?
I believe there's more than that.
Okay, well, anyhow, whoever wants to speak, you get a total of 4 minutes, so you can organize among yourself, and you want to come up, whoever is speaking on that? Somebody.
You're saying for all the people that wish to speak, we get a total
of 4? Yes, they got 4. At this point in the year, we have to limit people. That's what we're doing.
We recognize that, but let's give them the community.
Well, I think we're going to have to start, and if you want to use up your time arguing or making your points, I would hope it would be good that you would make points so that we would know.
We're about to hear from Ms. Holmes.
Yeah. Would you state your name and address?
My name is Michelle Gross, and I live in Minneapolis.
Okay.
And I am here representing an organization, Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis and St. Paul Twin Cities-based organization. We are very concerned about both the extension of this law and the law itself. This law is problematic for the reason that it is not clear in the language of the law who actually determines whether a complaint is false. Will it be the same police department that the person is complaining about? We have great concerns with this because our organization analyzed 10 years worth of Minneapolis Police Department internal affairs data of complaints between the years 1993 and 2003. Of the many hundreds of complaints that the internal affairs department received, they only sustained 2 complaints from community members during that time period. And this was, again, against many hundreds of complaints. The implication, then, is that the rest of those complaints are somehow false. And, in fact, when we dug into that, we found that that wasn't the case. They just simply didn't sustain the complaints. Does the non-sustaining of complaints then render those complaints false? According to the language of the law, not only is the complainant subject to prosecution, but anyone who, quote, causes information to be communicated to the police is also subject to being prosecuted. This could include attorneys, including the public defenders, those who represent clients to internal affairs, reporters writing stories about police abuse, and even advocates such as our own organization. We think that it's quite wrong to... Well, you can't prove police brutality to be subject to prosecution. We believe that this law is a violation of the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment rights to seek redress of government officials and to have free speech to criticize government officials. Moreover, we are concerned that the very first prosecution under this new law will have a chilling effect on people who wish to complain about police brutality and are afraid to do so. In fact, we believe this very well may be the intent of the law, is to prevent people from coming forward and blocking and talking about police brutality. Finally, the law validates the police assertion that false reporting is a problem and that police brutality is not commonplace, and these are assertions that we believe to be false. The law twists public opinion in favor of brutal police officers, and that is our problem with this law. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. You have a couple minutes left. Representative Farnas, we won't take any questions during their time.
Okay. After they're done?
After their time. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Jill Clark, and I am an attorney who acts pro bono for people of color in state criminal prosecutions. And I also...
Excuse me.
That's my backup band. Thank you. I also prosecute civil rights violations in federal courts, including cases involving police misconduct. There doesn't seem to be any reason for this statute. There was already a law on the books that would criminalize false complaints to law enforcement. What this law has done is to create a special group, a special crime, just to protect police officers. What is the basis for that? We have heard none. We would urge you not to pass this enlargement of the statute, and we do believe it is that, without going out, each of you, and speaking with at least 100 victims of police misconduct, and you will often find them in communities of color. It is alarming that many of the people who call my office are reporting not just police misconduct, but also retaliation for the reporting of police misconduct. How can you allow the police to be the ones to decide whether the police have done something wrong? The bias is built into the system. You've built it into your law. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently struck down a similar statute because it said it's an equal protection problem. And this was the analysis. How can you criminalize a false complaint of police misconduct but not criminalize false testimony by police officers that their fellow officer did not engage in misconduct? And let me give you an example. If civilian A complains that police officer A has physically assaulted them, and police officer A's two buddies, B and C, saw the whole thing, maybe there's even a videotape, and there are more and more videotapes of these incidents with cell phones out there. Say there's a videotape that shows that this occurred, but yet the police reports of officers B and C say, it didn't happen, he didn't do anything wrong, didn't see a thing. Why is that not criminal? That's also a false statement. Why is it also to law enforcement? What could more be a statement to law enforcement than a police report filed in the police system? So the Ninth Circuit struck this similar statute down.
You are over 2 minutes now, so you'll have to wrap it up. We are really tight on schedule right now.
Well, we will wrap it up by saying that we do intend to, the community intends to bring a federal declaratory judgment action to strike from the books the statute that you have already. And we would certainly invite questions from members of the committee, but before you enlarge such a statute designed to chill police complaints, public scrutiny of public officers, we'd ask you to take a second look.
Okay, we'll have 8 minutes of question, et cetera, amendments.
I didn't get a chance to speak.
Yes, but we did give your side the chance to speak. I'm sorry.
Sir?
We are.
I might be misinterpreting House Rule 6.22 regarding allowing.
We did allow that. You are misinterpreting.
I asked you on the calendar 3 times to pass the ball.
Sir, we have.
1 minute.
Sir, we have rules. We've set them up and they've been agreed on by the committee.
1 minute.
Sir, we are not. Representative Corn. Representative Corn. That was not our fault. That was held up on the floor. Representative Cornish?
Sir, I got a question for the other testifier that was up here in the blue there. She doesn't have to come up, but Mr. Chair, members, it's been lopsided actually against cops for too long. You're finally getting some fair play. To give you a couple of instances, when I was a
thief. Watch this.
Could you somebody take him out of here, please? Mr. Chair, to give you an idea how it works in the other way, I went out on a complaint once, and the attorney of this defendant made a complaint against me and said that I scared him and gave his mother a heart attack, and then I yelled and screamed at him, was physically abusive.
Representative Cornish, we're all scared.
And really the only thing that saved my butt after it was all done, I let him wave on and file his complaint through his attorney to the county attorney and besmirch my reputation. Luckily, I had a recording of it that he didn't know about. And if I wouldn't have had that, without a protection like this, cops are at a huge disadvantage because not all sheriffs and chiefs, but we've got too many weak-kneed sheriffs and chiefs that dance to the political bosses, and rather than tell the defendant that they did something wrong, they always got to put in the thing, well, I took care of that, and reprimand the cop, and just to be safe politically so they don't get sued. So it's helpful to have something in there like this, and we do need it for attorneys as well as citizens. I could give you other instances where I run a couple of people off the road on
Representative Cornish, you are cutting into people's time because, like I said, we're really having to go, and I think Representative De La Forest had a question.
Thanks.
And if we have extra time left over, then we can come.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Having held the gavel numerous times, Representative Johnson, who chaired this committee last time, was off on a different pursuit. I can appreciate that, but I don't know who would be good. I'd probably like to ask a question to one of the witnesses here, but maybe even to the author, considering that this is the committee that considers these type of constitutional claims, and I was intrigued by the equal protection argument, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as the lawyers in your know, is of binding persuasion. It certainly can inform us, and I just hope at some point here, whether it's a witness or the author, can explain in a little bit more detail what the constitutional questions are that are raised. It sounds like there are other jurisdictions that have considered this issue and have in fact ruled upon it, and as a member of the committee with the jurisdiction we have, I want to be as informed as I can before I cast a vote on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you state your name again? Nobody got it up here.
Sure, my name is Jill Clark.
Okay.
And I am an attorney and I practice constitutional law. My understanding of the analysis of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is this. The law has to apply equally to everyone. That a statute like this makes a special category for police. And it says if you make a false claim they've done something wrong, that's a crime. But where in the bill would be the equal side of the law, which is to say they've done something, to falsely state they've done everything right, is not equally criminalized. And so the statute was stricken from the books by the Ninth Circuit's Court of Appeals, declared unconstitutional under equal protection grounds. Obviously, the First Amendment is another prong of the problem because there could be a chilling impact on people complaining against their government, which is what the First Amendment is designed to protect. It is not binding, you are absolutely correct, on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, but it certainly is a well-respected circuit, and the analysis seems sound. And it's what I was trying to say, and obviously trying to say it a little bit quickly, but if you have a situation where the citizen says, police officer A did this wrong thing to me, he's the only citizen there, but there's three police officers. The other two, rather than telling the truth, and I'm just taking as a hypothetical, sometimes these police reports are written and the videotapes come up later. I've had several cases like that. So let's take the hypothetical where police officer A, on the videotape you can see him assaulting the citizen. But officers B and C say, oh, he didn't do anything wrong. Why are those false, proven to be false by the videotape statements, not likewise criminalized? That's where the equal protection problem lies. And it is a lawsuit that has been planned for some time by the community. It is something that has, I mean, essentially all ready to go, probably within the next week. Will be filed in the District Court of Minnesota on the statute as it exists now. The language that this bill would add would not cure the problem.
Well, Representative De La Force.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm really mindful of the time, but it does raise a question in my mind that I think it's important for the committee to consider here. And it sounds like what Ms. Clark is telling me, that we may have a legal issue that is ripe for adjudication, and it certainly begs the question of the author about the prudence of moving forward with a bill if we've got an issue that's ripe for adjudication. There have been numerous times where the legislature has pulled back, deferring to the courts. I don't know if this is one of those situations or not, Mr. Chairman, but I'd like to hear the chief author's comments.
Okay, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, number one, nobody approached me. After this bill's been filed, no one approached me with these concerns. It's the first I've been hearing about them. Number two, what they're testifying about is the current law. All we're doing is, with my bill here, is expanding the current law to people that work as a prop for the prosecuting authority, doing the investigation work, and extending this protection to them. On line 1.13, which was told to me is a very hard thing to prove, is that they knowingly have to give information that is false before they go after them.
And that's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Beyond a reasonable doubt. And to the point that they're talking about whether it doesn't apply to police officers that are caught on videotape doing things wrong, that if other officers swore to that, they would be guilty of perjury. So there is an equal protection there. This, what they're debating currently is current law. All we're doing is expanding it to people who are working in this as investigators for the police departments, investigators for different county attorneys, investigators even for public safety department. So, I mean, this is all it's doing. It's not, I mean, if we wanted to have a debate about the law and have it taken and the law gets struck down, I understand that, but this is a new law. This is existing law in the books. All we're doing is adding these additional
Representative
people.
Nelson, can I let Representative Felstrom and then Representative Rush, and then we're going to have to play it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Current law was my bill. I carried it. And there are a few things that I want to state. Filing a police report that's false is a crime. So it doesn't just apply to complaints about police officers. In statute, we have it as a crime if you file a false police report. And in terms of behavior of the police officer, if the police officer assaults someone, that is, too, a crime. And so if another officer lies about it, we also have disciplinary action. One of the reasons why I brought this bill forward previously is because what immediately happens when you're a police officer and someone files a complaint against you is you are immediately put on suspension with pay until they finish investigating what's going on. And so immediately you are assumed to be guilty prior to the investigation even taking place. And I thought that it was very important that we level that playing field a little bit and say that if you're going to file a claim, you better make sure that you are not willfully and knowingly filing a false claim, because it has serious implications on the police officers that we have in this state.
Thank you, Representative Lush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, I wasn't sure how I was going to vote on this, and this recent display, I think, kind of helped me out for an individual assault of Representative Cornish. Are you still a certified peace officer, Representative Cornish?
I'm going to what?
Nothing. I wasn't sure if you're still licensed or not.
Oh.
Anyway, it's good we have attorneys in the room here who can defend people like that. I guess, Ms. Clark, yeah, as a prosecutor, I wasn't sure how I was going to vote on this, and I was still thinking about it. It's my understanding that you, one of the things you do is you sue police departments and police officers for misconduct. Is that correct?
I represent clients who do that, yes.
Okay. And I didn't hear what you were saying, the community or committee that you have, what is that committee? I may have missed that part of the testimony that you represent.
I'm sorry. When I said the community was going to bring a declaratory judgment action?
Yeah, that's right. What community?
The community at large, various members interested in this issue.
Okay.
Kind of just a coalition of people.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Clark, is the class action you're pursuing then, or what?
DEC action.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I've got to say this.
No.
What? I won't say who said it.
No. We're
going to
lay the bill over.
Right? Okay, we'll talk to you later. So the bill is laid over, Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Anna. Next one is the Medora Bill, 1396. I think we should say that. Yeah. And Representative Johnson moves Representative Medora's bill and also moves the amendments. And do you know the number of the amendments? It's a delete off?
Me too, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you know the some do you have?
Yeah.
There are some changes to the
delete off?
Technical changes to the delete off.
That's the DE2?
Yes, Mr. Chair, number. I do have a delete off to my bill.
Representative Medora, Representative Johnson's already moved your delete off DE2, I assume.
Okay.
That's it.
All right.
And there's two changes to that, is there?
There are, yes. Mr. Chair, on line 1.11, you see the word metro area in greater Minnesota, comma. I'd like to add the word county, then adult protection, after protection, the word services, and then comma. So the line then will read metro area and greater Minnesota county adult protection services, comma. Then on the next line, 1.12, you see the word Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minnesota Association of Guardianship. At that point, we want to remove that comma, and we want to remove the word guardians, because it's a duplicate.
That's magic, then?
Yes.
Okay. Is that all?
That is all, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Johnson moves the amendment to the amendment. We'll, to get it in the shape that the author wants, we'll vote on that first, the amendment to the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, it carries. Now we'll vote on the amendment as amended. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Okay. Carries, it's now in the shape it's in, and I think it's very non-controversial, but go ahead and present your bill, Representative Medora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, 1396, yeah. is asking for a study to be convened to talk about guardian and conservatorship issues here in the state of Minnesota. I do have two testifiers that understand they need to be very brief.
Yes.
If that would be, if the committee would indulge, and they will speak directly to the outcome of the study that we're looking for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Will Wilson. I'm from the Mental Health Association. We represent individuals with mental illnesses with an emphasis on protecting their rights. Originally, well, the history of this is that over the last couple of years, we've been seeing more and more cases of individuals who have problems with guardians and conservators. And once they are appointed a guardian or a conservator because of being incapacitated due to a mental illness, it's very, very difficult to get off of a guardianship. And there's very little oversight into what the guardian or conservator does on behalf of a ward. And so what we tried to do with the bill that was originally before you was to come up with ways that we could add oversight by using an ombudsman's office, by making sure that the ward could see what is essentially the only oversight mechanism, which is the annual report that they file through a court. And then also we wanted to make sure that all guardians who perform the services are certified. We understand that that's been controversial, and with some other members of the committee that we've spoken with, that has been controversial. In the spirit of compromise, we've come up with a study, because the more we got into this, the more we realized that there were so many different jurisdictions that were crossed and so many different interest groups that had a stake in this, that we really did need to study the problem so we could come up with a solution, and that's the amendment before you.
And Mr. Wilson, I thank you for agreeing to this amendment that we worked with Representative Medora on. This is an area that I also practiced in, so I was very concerned about not having a very open thing. Representative Coles.
Very quick, Mr. Chair, probably for Representative Medora. I guess I'm not sure that we even need this bill. I guess I'd like to understand why the state court administrator can't convene this group without the legislation.
Representative Medora, do you want to attend?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. The reason we've asked for the study is that we'd like to have an end date to it, and we would like to gather this large collaborative of interest to finish it. If the at this point, if we were to just ask the administration, the state court administration department to do this, there wouldn't be a compelling reason for them to have an end date on it. So this just asks for the report and allows the chance for us to have some legislative review of those findings.
And Representative Coles, I was also one that very strongly wanted a requirement that the state court do this and report back to us, because this is an area that I'm concerned about, and I did talk to the Chief Justice and the Chief Court Administrator about doing these, and they agreed to it, but I still think the legislature often requires things of agencies or somebody else that they could do on their own, so I think that it's important to require it.
Yes.
Is there any other comments? Oh, you have another? Very quickly,
I'm
sir.
Very quickly.
I understand that.
You're doing well. The more you talk, the more problems you're going to have.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Steining, and I'm currently the president of the Minnesota Association of Guardians and Conservators, and we do support this bill to convene a group to study and look at ways to improve this system. We think it does make sense and could only help improve the practices out there.
Okay, thank you. Representative De La Forest. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Is there any opposition to this bill? Okay, Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a quick question for the bill author. Do you have an idea how much it'll cost, a fiscal note of any type, and is it going to come out of the state court's budget?
Representative Medora.
At this point, it's a nominal. If any, most of the stakeholders in this discussion are already, this would be part of their job description to get together to discuss this. So we believe that there would be a nominal, if any, fee to produce this report.
That was my understanding, but we'll check on it.
That come out of the state court's budget, Mr. Chairman, even regardless of the fees, costs?
Representative Medora, do you know that?
I do not know, Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about the bill itself, because we're talking about a study, which is, I suppose, fine. But what about the issue that we're going to open up confidential records to review of a third party? It looks like the ombudsman may now examine records generated in connection with the... Did I miss something? I'm sorry. I missed the DE amendment. My apologies.
I'm looking at Mr. Chair. I thought we already took care of that.
Yeah, sorry. I was wondering. Okay, thank you, Representative Medora. We'll lay that over for possible inclusion. And then we'll try and get another bill in here.
Thank you very much, Chair Member.
Representative Lesh has the Foley bill. You have the Foley bill?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Lesh. It's the Lesh bill, but Senator Foley's name is on our list.
What was that hand? The amendment?
Yeah.
Was it in your... Yeah, it was in my packet. Yeah.
We're not going to get to Maria's. We only got 8 minutes left. Representative Lesh, you would move your bill.
I would move Senator Foley's bill.
And this would be for possible inclusion, is my understanding. Go ahead, Representative Lesch, and present your bill.
Thank you. What number are we moving? I don't have a bill listed as Senator Foley's bill. I just have House files.
We've got, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, we have at the top, it says Senate file number 302, second engrossment, and it should be behind or maybe in front of the bill with my name on it.
Was House File 690. We're working off the Senate File 302.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll do a brief explanation, and Professor Simon described the corpus of the bill, but as I'm going to talk first about an initial amendment that was added on in the Senate that I would have added on as an author's amendment, which is one change to this bill in terms of the Senate file, and that is Senator Neville was very interested in pursuing a change in law for a constituent of his providing for operation of a trailer. If a trailer was a trailer was negligently attached and you had operation of that, it was included in the definition of motor vehicle. He had an incident in his district where a woman and her child were killed, and I saw that as an appropriate author's amendment to add trailers in as definitions of motor vehicle. Other than that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll have Professor Simon describe the rest of the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members of the
Mr. Simon.
My name is Steve Simon. There are two Steve Simons in the room. I am on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Law School. I am the chairman of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force, and the task force has asked for and is seeking the contents of Senate File 302. These are mainly technical amendments, and I'll go through them fairly quickly. One adds phlebotomists to the type of designated person who can draw a blood sample for DWI arrest where the person or the officer has elected that the person take a blood test. It was an oversight to leave phlebotomists out of the defined people who can draw such samples, and in your major hospitals, that's the person who takes most of the blood samples. Doesn't make any change in policy. Second change is to add metabolites to the provisions of the criminal vehicle homicide law that has to do with operating under the influence of a controlled substance. We made this change, you made the change last year in the DWI law itself by adding metabolites, and we failed to include it in the CVO, the DWI controlled substance provisions of the CVO, CVH, and so that's what that provision does. Again, it picks up what should have been done last year. Third change is it clarifies in a statute that requires that if the DCA performs an analysis of any type of test, and the person from the DCA is going to be, their testimony is going to be waived because they don't demand, the defendant doesn't demand their presence. The statute clarifies some case law which says that the defendant has to be advised of the consequence of their not demanding their presence. It doesn't change the policy, it just puts a more explicit warning of the consequence of not demanding the actual person who did the DCA test. Those are the three provisions in the law, and I say none of them are major policy changes. They're trying to reflect either recent case decisions or areas where the task force has discovered areas of the law that are making it more difficult for law enforcement.
Okay, is there any opposition to this bill? Okay, are there any questions or...
Mr. Chair, I should qualify something. You know, it was my understanding the trailer provision that I just described, I was approached by Representative Broad on the floor, who was also very interested in having this included. However, the version that I had seen on the floor included that as definition. I do not see it in this. If I can have a moment just to get my materials, I want to ensure that that amendment is in.
Okay, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, while he's looking for what he can, I'm just a little confused. Does the committee have Senate File 302, or are we using this as a delete everything? Or I just want to make sure that we're doing the right thing here. I'm a little confused.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles, House rules provide that if a committee has the Senate file before them, we act on that Senate file unless we moved to have the House file before us, and so that's what I was told.
Yeah, I guess my only question was, had Senate File 302 been referred to the committee? I see Ms. Benson shaking her head. Yes, I trust it has. That I was a little confused by the paper in front of me.
We could substitute the House language and work from that, but it doesn't make sense. Representative Pamar, did you want to try to get your bill in? If they're about done, can you do it in 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. We'll see if the committee lets you do it in 5 minutes. But at least we'll take your witness's testimony. Go ahead, Representative Lush, if you're...
Could Professor Simon, this is why he's a professor and I'm not. He found it on page 4. So it is included in there, Mr. Chair.
This was mistaken. Representative Westrum?
Mr. Chair, just Professor Metabolite. What is that substance?
Metabolite is a substance produced by the body from its normal processing of anything that can be basically a drug. Usually it's a drug. Where the classic example and the main reason for this is cocaine. Cocaine is metabolized by the body so fast the person can be impaired while they're driving by cocaine. By the time the officer gets a blood sample, which would usually be an hour and a half later, the cocaine has been changed by the normal bodily processes so that it doesn't exist as a drug anymore, but the downstream, the subsequent chemicals, the metabolites of cocaine, are in the body. And so when they analyze the blood sample, they don't find any cocaine, but they find substances that can only have come from cocaine. And by adding metabolites, that allows the prosecution of that person, because the person from the DCA can then say, this person had cocaine in their body. Because we found these substances that only can be there if the person took cocaine 2 or 3 hours ago.
So, Representative Westrum?
Well, that helps clarify. I'm assuming that it's scientific such that other products that we legally consume can't be confused for that. And is it alcohol as well? And it's not... The dietary supplement metabolite, is it?
Mr. Chairman, the simple answer is correct. If the substance has to be produced of the language of the statute says controlled substance or its metabolite. So there has to be a connection, a scientific connection, that this substance came from an illegal drug.
Representative Immer, do you have one to that point?
No, another part of that.
I have one to that point. I was at an AG seminar for their prosecutors this fall, and they were talking about there is a drug that's scheduled because it has the same metabolite as cocaine, and yet it has no... I think it was the DCA was saying that it has no effect on the body, and they were wondering why we had it on there, so... Is that the same kind of a problem here or not, or is that something different?
There are individuals from the DCA who can answer that question. That's a fairly technical one, and they're in the audience, and they can answer that question, Mr. Chairman.
Could one of them come up and while Representative Emmer's asking his question? Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Would you ask your question?
Yeah, we're
waiting to come up. On
I thought we were still on the AG's thing.
Yeah.
Subdivision 1B, 3.25 through 3.28. Could the professor or Representative Lesh just explain why that's important, that new language on conviction not bar to punishment for other crimes?
Mr. Simon or Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, that's not something that we recommended, but I have a feeling that's in there to prevent the operation of 609035 and to allow a person who's convicted of this violation to also be convicted for, say, intentional crimes that arise out of the driving conduct. There's a statute, Minnesota statute 609035, that says if you're convicted of one crime, you can only get one sentence and actually one conviction for all of the crimes that arise out of that behavior. But there's numerous exceptions in 609035 where the legislature, burglary is a good example, where you can be convicted of burglary and sentenced on burglary, convicted of the substantive crime you commit after you commit the burglary and receive a separate sentence.
Representative De La Forest, a quick question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Good to see you again, Professor Simon. I had a question regarding going back to Representative Westrum and the metabolite, and it appears in my quick reading of the statute that if a person is not under the influence of any type of substance, you need to prove gross negligence, essentially, to be subject to the penalty under Section 2. regarding the metabolites, I'm just curious, is there a scientifically established nexus between having a metabolite in the body and a diminished control of the vehicle that would justify only a negligent manner to be subject to the penalty as opposed to grossly negligent, I guess, if you're sober?
And again, somebody from the BCA can answer that. But you normally, the metabolite doesn't impair you. Usually it's the drug itself. And there's some drugs, actually, like alcohol is one where the impairment comes not so much with alcohol, but from some of the byproducts, the metabolites of alcohol. Mm-hmm. Generally, the metabolite doesn't impair you for most drugs. But and the statute is written that for controlled substances, they don't have to prove impairment. And the law is limited to controlled substances.
Representative Rush, I'm going to, at this time, lay over your bill. We have to get Representative Pamar's witness on his, and then we won't let him go any further than that, but we're going to do that, and hopefully Chair Dreiling won't throw us out bodily. Representative Pamar, do you want to?
Is that my bill, or just the witness? Otherwise, we're waiting for Monday.
Well, we have to be out of here physically in about 3 minutes.
What, can we hear it on Monday then?
Okay, we'll do that. And I'm sorry. Yes, we can each ask questions of those outside the committee times because we have to be out of here, Representative De La Forest. So the committee is adjourned. Oh, I'm sorry. The committee is in recess. We're back from recess. The first thing I'll do is announce we're sending bills down to the subcommittee chaired by Representative Lash. Will be these bills: House File 1220, Hillstrom; House File 239, Lash; House File 414, Liebling; House File 506, Olin; House File 1273, Crayons; House File 1354, Paymar; House File 1841, Simon; House File 1858, Cornish; and House File 1859, Cornish. And my understanding is those are on for hearing tomorrow morning at
9 o'clock, is it?
Move for 11 now?
Okay.
Then the first go tonight will be House File 999, Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney and Representative Kalin will move your bill, House File 99, for possible inclusion in our omnibus. Yes.
It's fine with me then, sir.
Okay.
An author's amendment.
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
A1, author's amendment. I think the pages are going to have to pass it out.
Okay, would the pages start passing out, Representative Mahoney's A1 bill? And in the meantime, Representative Kalin moves your A1 bill. I mean, your A1 amendment.
How about if I
don't know if we should label your bill A1.
Oh, of course. How about if I just explain it while they're passing that out? And
exactly.
By the time they get that passed out, then the testifier can come up and pass it out. What this bill does, I tried to keep it very focused, is if you have a foreign national or an American citizen or a resident of Minnesota, marry, have a child, whatever, and they proceed to get divorced, for child support, and I'm just going to use an example, I have no idea what the number might be, but let's say it was, child support was $500 in the state of Minnesota for one child, and the foreign national takes the child, upon agreement, the other parent, the non-custodial parent, moves back to the country of origin. And the cost of living is dramatically less because of the exchange rate or anything else. All this bill does is allow that to be taken into consideration by the judge when setting child support. Legal Aid came to me with some concerns about the ability to get back in court if the foreign national moved back to the states. And once this amendment gets passed out, it's on page 2.7. Mediation is granted under section whatever, subdivision 1, paragraph 4. The child can no longer maintain a comparable standard of living with the lower child support because the child resides in, no longer resides in a foreign country, is added. I have my testifier here, and I have, well, I'm not going to, I have his testimony written down, but I think because they're still passing stuff out, unless the committee would really like it, I'll just keep it here. And he can read his testimony and you can listen. Would that be all right?
Yes, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could call Mr. Castro to the witness table.
Mr. Castro?
Yes.
State your name and then go ahead and give your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Ronaldo Castro. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to address this Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. As stated, my name is Ronaldo Castro, and with me today is my wife, Chelsea, our three-year-old daughter, Abby, our four-month-old daughter, Grace, is at home with Grandma, hopefully sleeping. I'd like to speak specifically to my situation and how the proposed amendment would impact my family here in Minnesota, and as well as my daughter who lives in the Philippines. My ex-wife was born, raised, and educated in the Philippines. Her family lives there, and she plans to continue to raise our daughter there. My divorce papers followed Minnesota child support guidelines requiring 25% of my earned income to be paid for child support. And I have been diligent in providing that support to my daughter. I would like to give some examples why I am encouraging you to support this amendment, which states consideration of child's residence in a foreign country when deviating from presumptive child support. The current peso to dollar exchange rate between the Philippines and the United States is 40 pesos per dollar, per $1. The cost of living in Minnesota is not comparable to the cost of living in the Philippines. It has been 10 years since I've lived in the Philippines, so I asked my parents, who still live in the Philippines, to give me an example of their current household expenses. My daughter, who lives with her mother, and my parents live near each other in the North Capital Region, an affluent part of the Philippines. According to the Philippine Labor Market Information website, the average income of a family of four in this region is $420.68 per month. My parents support a household of five adults, providing food, shelter, clothing, and transportation. Their monthly expenses are $525 a month for five adults. I currently send $820 to the Philippines for food, shelter, clothing, education, transportation, as a contribution to the daily needs of my daughter. Compare the $525 for a household of five adults to $820 for one child. So if you think about it, I send $820 support for one child. A family of four has an average income of $420 a month, and my parents' household of five adults live on $525 a month. As you can see, although the 25% earned income standard may be fair in Minnesota to support a child, the same 25% sent to a country where the cost of living is much lower is not fair and equitable. Wording in this bill states, maintain a comparable standard of living with a lower amount of child support. I'm confident that I can provide the appropriate standard of living for my daughter, meeting her daily needs, with reduced amount of supports, because each dollar I provide in support goes so much further in the Philippines economy. And members of the committee, I want to assure you that I'm not trying to shirk my responsibilities to support my daughter in the Philippines. I am willing to provide my fair share of child support. I am only hoping for a fair and equitable solution to the current dilemma. Fair for my daughter in the Philippines, and also fair for my new family here in Minnesota. Although the percentage of non-custodial parents who pay child support outside the United States is very small, amending the child support law to consider the difference in cost of living would have a great impact on the lives of those families. Thank you for your consideration of this much-needed bill. I encourage you to offer your support, and I am anxious to answer any questions.
Are there any opponents to this bill? Okay, are there any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, can you tell me, there's a difference in a cost of living between the metropolitan area and rural Minnesota, currently in Minnesota. Do we take that into account in the current child support law?
Representative Mahoney.
I'd have to ask staff to look at that. But my suspicion is no.
Okay.
But there's, Representative Hilson, the disparity between metro counties versus rural counties is not the same as it would be between Minnesota and the Philippines, or Minnesota and Peru, or any other place. And I think this is a pretty small number of people that this bill will affect. It's not fair to someone to make them wealthy beyond their dreams for 18 years in one country, then all of a sudden have that fall off.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, is it your intention, if this makes it into the omnibus bill, to offer that as an amendment maybe later to take other considerations into account before I decide whether or not I want to support the provision?
I made a promise to the chair that I would not amend anything this year, and I will keep that.
All right.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. I think there's no further questions. We'll lay over your bill for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Rubio, will do yours. We will. Is there any opposition, do you know?
Just so I want an amendment.
You've got an amendment, I understand that.
Yes.
Representative Rubin, we hopefully can do it in about 4 minutes.
Yep.
Go ahead. Let's see, Representative Paymar moves Representative Root's bill number 1074. Go ahead, Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today for your possible consideration of House Bill 1074, the Starling Move to Revise Uniform Management.
I'm sorry, we don't yet have the bill, so we're doing an informational hearing, so we can't move it until we get it, technically. So
you're going to get it, though.
It's an informational hearing, but something got hung up. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Darlene Luther was a former member of the House, and I think several members on this committee served with her. She herself was a recipient of a liver transplant before she died of cancer in 2002. This act is brought forward by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform Health Laws and Life Source. The act was written to increase the number of lives saved through transplantation by providing uniformity in state laws, harmonizing law with current practices, and clarifying how individuals can document their wishes to donate along with who may make gifts for a person who has died. Here with us today to testify in support of this legislation is Susan Gunderson, Chief Executive Officer of Life Source.
Ms. Gunderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Susan Gunderson. I'm the Chief Executive with Life Source. Based in St. Paul, we're the nonprofit organization federally designated to support and facilitate organ donation in Minnesota and North and South Dakota. We're here to eagerly support and endorse this legislation. Actually, I'm here for three reasons. First of all, organ transplantation works, but sadly, many people die simply because there are not enough organs available for transplantation. Secondly, the state has a significant responsibility in addressing this public health crisis. And third, the revised Uniform Gift Act will help save lives for Minnesotans by establishing a clear and more consistent legal framework for donation. Organ donation is a purely voluntary decision that must be clearly conveyed before an individual's organs can be available for transplant. Let me highlight just a few of the key changes in the new legislation that I think are important for us to consider here. It brings much needed consistency with federal legislation requiring all hospitals to report deaths to the donation agency. It strengthens the power of an individual to make a personal decision about donation. It provides clarity to the decision-making process regards who can provide authorization on the behalf of the deceased if that individual had not made a decision during their lifetime. It clarifies the distinction between a revocation and a document of gift and a refusal to make a gift. A revocation is an ambiguous act, and a documented refusal is an intentional act which cannot be overturned by an individual other than the person who made that decision. This is an important distinction, and let me give you just an example. We are frequently meeting with individuals in the public, and it's not uncommon for someone to say, oh, I had donor on my driver's license, but I took it off because I'm old and I've got diabetes and no one would want any organs that I have. I'd really like to donate, but I took it off because I'm old. That's simply a misunderstanding, and it's really not a revocation. It's a revocation, but it's not a refusal. And I think this distinction is important. It's also completely consistent with language in the living will statute that's currently on record. We're also very pleased that the new legislation honors the wish of an individual to make their own decision, similar to what the Darlene Luther Anatomical Gift Act passed in 2001 also does. We are really encouraged that this legislation is under active consideration in many states right now, in a majority of states across the United States. In fact, I'm really pleased to report that just today, the governor of South Dakota, a state not necessarily known for being the first in change in this area, signed a bill enacting the Uniform Gift Act. So we're pleased that our neighbors to the west have taken this step. Uniformity in state laws is particularly important in transplantation because this work crosses state lines every day and lives depend on a consistent and rapid implementation of the donation process. Let me share just an example with you. 2 years ago, a young man from Edina High School, Connor, was in need of a life-saving heart transplant. His story was widely covered in the media. He received the gift of life from a young man from Seattle who happened to die in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. This donor had learned about donation and expressed his wishes to donate in the state of Washington. He died in a hospital in South Dakota, and his heart was transplanted in Minneapolis. He donated 5 other organs as well as tissues and eyes. This case touched many individuals and really emphasizes the need for consistency and uniformity across states. Minnesota has long been a leader and a strong supporter of donation, and this is reflected in a higher than average rate of donation and sign up on our driver's license in our state. Sadly, there are still thousands who are awaiting transplants, and many will die before their chance comes. Under the leadership of Pat McCormick within the Department of Public Safety, the state has played and continues to play an active role in addressing this community health concern. We at LifeSource have access to information about an individual donor designation status at the time of death from their driver's license so that we can be sure to fulfill their wishes. We also work with the state to provide materials to all driver's education instructors so that they can include education about donation in the curriculum as per state law. The flyers, which are also being distributed to you, are ones that are available in all driver's license bureaus right now. You'll see when you receive that a picture of a young girl, Alexa, who died at the age of 14 while she was awaiting a lung transplant. Her cause and her message is one that we want to convey to all Minnesotans so that other children and adults don't die needlessly waiting for an organ transplant. It is our hope that Minnesota will continue to be a leader in this life-saving and life-affirming work of donation and transplantation. We're very pleased to see the legislation, you're considering this legislation, and I would encourage each of you to affirmatively support it. Stand ready for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Root, as I have discussed with you, I have a major concern with this bill. Having been active with representing university hospitals at the time that the first original was enacted and working with Dr. Najarian, and I actually drafted the forms for all the university hospitals in the country, I'm a little bit familiar with this issue, and I have a lot of concern about the fact that under this bill, if I retract my donation card, then somebody else can give my organs, even though in my mind, that is, if I did that, and most people I've talked to over many, many years of practice, too, not back to 1900, but many years, they think that terminates it, the ones I've talked to, and that's a lot of people. And So I don't like that part about this bill. I think that's a problem, and I think we need to work on that as we go ahead. But Representative Olin has an amendment, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair?
And we can't move on it. We're going to discuss it.
Mr. Chair?
This is an informational hearing. We couldn't move the bill, so we can't.
And just so I appreciate that, I think I understand what's going on. Representative Thielen chatted with me briefly, but is this bill on general register right now, and what's the intent if it is? I mean, I look at the engrossment here, it appears as though it is. So I just want to understand exactly what's going on. And I understand Representative Olin's going to talk to his amendment now, and that's fine. But I just want to understand procedurally exactly where
Representative Coles, as you know, we have authority to do informational hearings.
Right.
And so we're trying to get as much out of the way before next week when we get inundated with the last, and then we're trying to put together our bills. So we didn't want to wait with things we knew were coming, especially this one. And so we're doing this informational hearing to get all the discussion, get the amendment on the table, get it discussed so that we won't have to take as much time when we actually get the bill.
Understood, Mr. Chair. So I guess my question to you then is, do you intend, am I incorrect that the bill is the bill on the general register? And if it is, do you intend to have it recalled to the committee?
Yes.
Okay, all right, great.
That's why
now I
don't want to hear bills that aren't coming here.
You've
got enough to keep us busy.
You said when it's coming here, feels as though it had people in the past that thought it had made all its committee stops. Apparently it hasn't. That's great. I just want to understand exactly what's going on here.
Yes, sir. Representative Coles.
Clear as mud.
Representative Olin, you have an amendment. We can't formally make the motion. If the 370 amendment, and maybe you would like to explain it, and we can have a short discussion on it so that we don't have to go through that again when we actually get the bill.
Okay, basically this amendment is very short. It just refers to the making of an anatomical gift shall not itself authorize a direct denial of health care. What's trying to be avoided by this is the unintended possibility that somebody could rush along to rush somebody's death by a couple days because of the use of the organs. We're not trying to, what we're trying to do is avoid something that could happen, not something that's necessarily intended by what the bill does itself. I don't believe the actual intent of the bill does that, or that the author intends it, but it could allow it to happen without adding this amendment.
Does Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, so we're not going to vote on this, but you will allow additional amendments when the bill is properly before the committee, is that correct?
Yes, we would. I'd hope that you would, if you could, make them tonight so we could discuss them. If you can't do it yet, then we'll take them up at the time.
Mr. Chair, I don't have it
okay. Tonight.
Is
there any discussion of the Olin Amendment or a discussion of the bill? Representative Holbert?
Yes, I'd like to know what current law is. My recollection is relative to minors, provisional driver's license holders, that if they sign that they're donors, that holds, that it can't be changed. Is that current law?
I'm going to defer that answer to somebody else.
It's another Susan, I believe.
Right.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Susan Mal Larson, and I'm Director of Public Affairs for LifeSource. So you're right. Susan makes it easy. As per current law, a minor can designate their wishes to donate on their driver's license. A parent has to sign the driver's license application, and then a parent has to provide authorization at the time of donation. So that is consistent both with current law and this new revision.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, I share the concerns that you have relative to this bill, and I'd also like you to look at the part about the unemancipated minor. If they have signs of refusal, that then the parents may change that. I think we should respect the wishes of these kids, and people refuse whether they're 16 or whatever. So, it seems like you've set this up that every which way to Sunday, people can override the wishes, other than a very prescriptive process that most won't even be aware of, and that concerns me.
Representative Fulberg, you're not the only one. With no further discussion, Representative Gould, do you support or oppose or neutral on any of
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, we had some discussion before, and we're fine with that amendment, and also want to just have it on the record that we have had our discussions, and we'll be working to find a resolution and agreement on the issues that are concerned.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rue. Nothing's going to happen on the bill till we get it, and apparently you'll be, hopefully, maybe you can get her the amendment before the next meeting.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess if she's planning on addressing your concerns, I'm hopeful that she'd also address the issue of minors. Either what they say means something or it doesn't, but you can't twist it both ways. Then a no doesn't mean no, but a yes means yes.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been a strong supporter. Darlene Luther was a great friend of mine, and so I hope that we can do whatever we can to make this work out. Because it really is important, and it the transplant that Representative Luther had really did prolong her life, and it is a positive thing for Minnesota.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, I think many of us are very supportive of the Act. We're just concerned about certain parts, and I do believe some parts of the Act, in my understanding, have to basically should be done to conform to federal law. Is that correct? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's enough for tonight. We'll call you back when
Thank
we get
you
the bill. Is Representative Abler here? Okay. Representative Bunn here? Is Representative Clark here? We've got Smith Knight here.
Jesus.
Smith, you might as well start.
I think, Mr. Chairman, right?
The other night we had Representative Olin Knight. Today we have Representative Smith Knight. Looks like you're well prepared.
Mr. Chairman,
could you tell me which bill you would like to take up?
I'll tell you what, Mr. Chairman, we do have, in order, it's fine with me.
Okay.
We have the list of 1342, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith, you would like to move 1342 then?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House File 1342. It would be recommended to pass, and I believe we referred to the Committee on Public Safety Finance. Is that correct?
Yes. 1342. Okay, Representative Smith, do you want to go ahead?
I do have a witness. I'd ask her to come forward now. Mr. Chairman and members, joining me is Marnie Anderson, and she's the Executive Director of WATCH. I'll let her describe that, and that their mission is to assist in making justice system more effective and responsive in handling cases of violence, particularly against women and children. House File 1342, I'll just briefly tell you.
Representative Smith, just one second. Do you know of any opposition to it?
I am not aware of any, no.
Okay, would 4 minutes be okay?
More than adequate. I'm going to let Ms. Anderson take the mic and consume the opposition.
Ms. Anderson?
Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. WATCH is a court-monitoring organization. We operate in Hennepin County, and we also are expanding our model nationally. Our goal is to inform the public about what's happening in local jurisdictions. The bill before you adds the crimes of murder and manslaughter to the list of qualified domestic violence offenses. This is important because, according to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, likely to commit homicide are between the ages of 18 and 24. It's very unlikely that convicted murderers serve lifetime sentences in Minnesota. Most are released within 15 to 20 years and may have several decades to commit subsequent acts of violence. There's currently an inconsistency in the enhancement statute that you have. It recognizes many acts of violence committed against family or household members that will increase future charges. that the most violent act, the act of murder, under the current statute does not enhance future acts of violence. Each year in Hennepin County alone, defendants who have proven their lethality with prior murder convictions do not face enhanced charges for committing subsequent domestic assaults. The change to this bill provides an additional tool to hold repeat offenders accountable, and it will prevent escalating violence. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'll take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Are you now the one that runs Watch? Or
I am.
That's the one that Susan Lundfeske started?
Susan Lundfeske is our founder.
Okay. Are there any questions on this bill, Representative Coles?
Mr. Chair, for Representative Smith, or for the witness, can you help me understand on Section 3 of the bill, we're making an amendment to the crime of violence definition that's in 6.4712, and we are adding, for example, assault in the fifth degree and harassment, and while those are certainly not good things by anybody's definition, I don't believe that assault in the fifth degree is necessarily always a crime of violence. I think many of us may have witnessed one on Representative Cornish earlier. I think characterized it as a crime of violence. But help me understand that. Help me feel a little more comfortable about that being here.
Well,
Ms. Larson, Ms. Anderson,
when it exists in the context of domestic violence, it is a crime of violence. And it's used to intimidate, usually to threaten greater harm. And I would agree with you in a lot of situations that we have in daily life. It is not it's not a crime of violence, but in the context of domestic violence it is, and this is what this bill is addressing.
Mr. Chair, for the witness, or for staff, is 624.712 specific to domestic violence, or... I think I might have heard a phone a friend out of the audience here, Mr. Carlson, saying, yes, and if that's the case, then I understand what's going on, and I think I'm okay, at least for now, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, how many more does Representative Lewis have left?
I think it was staff that had that phone a friend. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Are there any other discussion?
Just a point of personal privilege that my father has actually volunteered for Watch over the years, and I think he continues to, depending on schedule. And I just want to thank you guys for the good work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're actually trying in the neighborhood group to get Watch to train neighborhood groups to go down on neighborhood issue crimes. So,
yeah, thank you.
All in favor, then Representative Smith renews his motion to pass and send it to Finance Committee. It can't go directly to Public Safety Finance. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? I'm curious. Representative Smith, do you want...
Mr. Chairman, we can go in the order you have listed.
Okay, 1,500?
Yes, sir.
All right. Is this the one that you said you had a big amendment?
Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do, and I did discuss this with you, I'd like to move the bill, and then I have an author's oral amendment. It was simple, but it's extensive throughout the bill, and... So, when you're ready.
No, Representative Smith, I'm sorry, but there's a A1 amendment. Is that yours or
Mr. Chairman? That is not my amendment. A representative from a legal aid advocacy group is here, and after some discussion with her, and it will become more clear as I give you a very brief dissertation on what I'm trying to do here tonight. She prevailed upon me to agree that she could present this. I will present the amendment, but it is not mine. It's for an additional addition of a sentence, a sort of language that I feel is a very, very small policy change, but it looks like it's one that could fit in what this legislature has done before and what I think this committee could do. So while it's not my amendment, I'm willing to offer it after I do the oral.
Okay, thank you for explanation, Representative Smith. Go ahead with Mr.
Chairman. I would move the following oral amendment, and I would go slow. First of all, it's basically an amendment to delete. I would move deletion of Section 1 in its entirety, and it's found on pages 1 and 2. The motion is also for deleting Section 2, which is found on page 2. Then I would direct your attention to page 20 of the bill. And the oral motion is one to delete the following sections. Number 20, number 21, and then going over to page 24, the deletion going on of section 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, which is on page 26, and section 28. We're not here with the pairing night.
Oh, no.
Okay, I would ask you to go as part of the motion to page 9. And you will see on lines 9.8, 9.9, and 9.10, the bill before you has lines in existing language crossed out. I would, as part of the motion, move that that language be restored. In other words, remove the interlineation. There's one more. I would direct your attention to page 17. I'm sorry, page 17. Then on two different lines, Mr. Chairman, lines 27 and 30. You see some added or spousal maintenance.
Right.
As part of the motion, I would ask that that additional language as proposed be deleted.
Okay.
So staff has any questions? If not, I'll explain what I'm trying to do.
Representative, I think I have it. I think staff has it. I think everybody has it. So if there's a question before we vote, we'll take it. So go ahead and... I'm sorry. You make the motion. We have to vote to get it into the shape that you want it in. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Okay, that carries. Mr. Chairman, Ann Martineau is here to answer any specific questions on language that you're leaving in the bill. But very briefly, the language that you've deleted. By the way, House File 1500 originally presented itself to me as an agency bill, as a cleanup bill to the family law modifications that we passed in 2005. Now, everybody at this table except the freshman, I believe, voted for the family law bill in May of 2005. With some exceptions. Rather, my phrase did include the words, I believe. And that bill took a long time in getting to where it was in 2005, and it also had a very long startup date, which was only January 1 of this year, 2007. There were reasons for that. Some legitimate, some political, just to put it off.
That's why we're just getting the calls now.
Yeah. The point is that bill has only gotten started in 1-1 of this year. This bill presented itself as an agency bill, and frankly, as the author, my intent was to resist any attempt to tamper with the bill to see how it would work in the beginning of this year. But only if there were minor technical changes, language, or definitional clarifications. The bill was introduced, House File 1500. The closer we got to this hearing, the more concerned I became with the items that were deleted. I'm not going to go into extensive discussion, but they are beyond technical changes. What is left in the language clearly is minor changes, language clarifications, adding some language in notices. What was deleted basically were policy changes, in my opinion. And at this point, if there are no questions, I would propose we move to the additional amendment and have that test.
Okay.
Melinda?
Well, Representative Smith, do you want to first explain your bill, or do you want to do you want this amendment to go on as the way the author wants it, or
I think how do you want it? Think I would like the this bill is moving where what's the motion?
I believe it's just it's going to we often we're planning on having a family law omnibus.
Okay, so this would be laid over.
It'll be laid over for possible.
I guess frankly what I'd like to do is have the bill laid over and not vote on the amendment, but have it discussed here and then laid over for later action. Is that acceptable?
That's okay. You will do it that way.
I'm going to run through what's left of 1500 very briefly.
Yes, could you? I'd like to get to your bill.
Okay. What is that left? Section 3, Mr. Chairman.
You did a great job of explaining what you took out.
I'll try to. Ann Martin also is here if you have any really deep questions I'm going to ask her. Section 3, Mr. Chairman and Committee, adds to the notice form that the law requires to be sent to all parties that the public authority may remove or resume the medical support offset under specific circumstances. And that additional language is found on page 3, lines 24 through 27. Section 4 that remains in the bill, which is on page 6, thank you. Is simply an instruction to the state court administrator, not the Commission of Human Services, that the state court administrator shall prepare the financial affidavit form that the parties would use to determine the financial information required by the law. And it's section 4. Section 5, which is on page 6.
7.
Excuse me, 7. Thank you. Section 5 is clarification language referencing potential income applies to orders for past support or reimbursement of the authority. Section 6, which is on the same page, is also clarification language referencing potential income applies to parents employed on less than a full-time basis. Section 7, which begins on page 7, also clarification language on that same issue. Section 8, same thing. Section 9, which is on page 8, we have restored some of the language as I previously discussed, but it also adds a factor to be considered, a substantial change of circumstances, that being availability of appropriate health care coverage, a substantial increase or decrease in health care coverage. That's what's left in Section 9. Section 10, which begins on page 11, references the child care costs or the total amount received by the provider from the applicant and any public agency. Section 11, which is on that same page, is clarification language, in my opinion, and it references when the public authority can suspend or resume collecting child care support. Section 12 is definitions, that's found on page 12. Section 13, which is on page 13, beginning, does add some language to existing law referencing that any child support order must state how unreimbursed or uninsured medical expenses will be allocated between the parties. That's section 13. On section 14, which is on the next page beginning, it is an instruction to the court relative to the parents' health care coverage and the comprehensiveness of the parents' health care coverage. Section 15, beginning on page 15, well, it's adding dental coverage. If the child does not have dental, the court may order that as part of the package. Admittedly, that was left out of previous law, but my opinion that it's an incidental modification. Paragraph 16, we've dealt with that. I think what's left... is a relatively innocuous modification. We've addressed the spousal maintenance and made that with our motion. Section 17, which begins on page 18, is clarifying language. Section 18 is enforcement language. That's found on page 18. And it just changes the language of health and dental insurance to health care coverage. And then we have section 19, which is offset language allowing medical support offset as contained in that section. Then we go along to the deleted sections until we get to section 22, which I think I left in the motion, and that's on page 23, excuse me. And it's clarifying language that the cost of living adjustment applies to basic support. The word child is deemed a basic. That's what's there.
Okay, now how do you,
unless there's questions,
you want to just, since we're going to lay it over, do you want, to just have her present her argument on this possible amendment? Is that,
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what I would like, so that there's a flavor for what she's asking now, that that is essentially new beyond what we've discussed. But I'd like the amendment to be presented. I'll move it.
Okay.
And then I would ask you to lay it over and bring it along with this to be considered later.
Okay, we'll take it exactly as you said. We'll, you can move the amendment. We won't vote on it. We're going to lay it through the bill, and so it will come with the bill then.
Yes.
And at that point, we have to vote on it on or not.
Or not, yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I move the amendment styled
A1.
A1. And
state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Melinda Hugdahl from the Legal Services Advocacy in St. Paul. I want to thank Representative Smith for working on, with us on this amendment. This is an amendment we've talked about with several members, many members, over the course of the session. The law prior to January 1st allowed that if a person was disabled, the amount that they earned was the amount that they earned. The court wouldn't impute or add income to them beyond their what they were earning already because they could establish to the court that they were disabled. That provision, through the process of recodification of the adoption of the new law, disappeared as of January 1st. We had attempted last year to put it back into the bills, and we believe as part of a drafting error in the last night of the session, it came out of the bill. So what this amendment does, when I talked to the department about this issue, they were happy to help incorporate it into the bill. They just picked up the wrong language. So what this does is reinstates the physically or mentally incapacitated language, term of art, that was the language from before January 1st, so that the law is consistent for those people from December to January and forward. And the retroactivity is simply to make that a seamless transition for people who are disabled, so we don't create a new standard, a new litigation about what a verified disability is. So,
is there any discussion or questions on the amendment? Okay, then Representative Smith, is there any discussion on the bill at this time?
Mr. Chairman, given Representative Smith's oral amendment, I believe lines 1 through 6 through 1 through 8 would not be needed because that provision's been deleted from the bill. That deals with the redirection section. And so that part of the amendment, I don't think would be necessary.
1.6 through 1.8?
Right. It references page 22, line 14, and that's from a section that was deleted.
Okay. Representative Smith, I assume that you want...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just get some clarification from Representative Smith as to why we're not going to vote on this part. It seems fairly non-controversial.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, it's either way. If you want to vote on it, just simply attach it to the bill and then lay it over as amended. I'm agreeable with that.
We could do that, too.
Mr. Chair, that piece of all of the family law stuff that I voted against seems at least the least harmful. So I have no issue with actually, you know, voting on that piece.
It weighs very hard, Mr. Chairman.
That is exactly. Representative Smith, then, He's already moved it. So then, unless there's further discussion on the A1 amendment... Oh, first we would have to delete... I guess you didn't technically make the motion that she suggested.
Mr. Chairman, I would move...
deletion of 1.6 through 1.8.
I would move the deletion. On the H1500A1 amendment, I would... can I incorporate the deletion of those lines in my motion?
Yes, you could.
I would, as an author, incorporate the deletions of line 1.6 through 1.8 on the A1 amendment, and I would move the A1 amendment as amended.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on the A1 amendment as amended? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Carries, and Representative Smith, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith, the next one is 821, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, I have a witness as well. Mr. Chairman,
Smith, you want to move?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out the motion. I think we want to do a motion that this be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Is that correct or not?
No, Representative Smith, first of all, it would be laid over, but there's monetary, and so it will go to finance.
That's right.
Representative Smith, I assume that you, I will take your motion to be that this be passed and referred to the finance.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Smith, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to just let my witness within 2 minutes lay the bill on you for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brock Hunter. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers tonight. Also present is Robert Sikora from the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it's simply an inflationary adjustment to the property crime dollar thresholds. Historically, the Minnesota legislature has adjusted these dollar thresholds four different times, 1963, 79, 83, and 87. It's now been 20 years since the last adjustment, and during that time, inflation has driven up prices to nearly twice what they were in 1987. A particular concern is the felony threshold that's currently set at $500. That was last adjusted back in 1987, as I said. And because of inflation, we're finding that more and more property crimes are being charged as felonies. And we're feeling that these are not the types of crimes that the legislature originally intended to be felonies. particularly crimes related to damage to automobiles, whether it be a broken window, a scratch to paint. Nearly any type of damage to an automobile is now a felony. And with that comes the burden of a felony conviction on someone's record and all of the collateral consequences that come with it. Also troublesome is the cost to the court system, to the public defenders, to the county attorneys in prosecuting felonies. They can attest that felonies cost much more to process through the courts than a gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor. And again, appeals and adjustment is necessary. We are simply asking that the $500 felony threshold be raised to $1,000. The handout provided to the committee shows that that would bring the threshold back into alignment roughly with inflation and get us back on track after this 20-year lag time in dealing with this matter. John Kingray from the County Attorneys Association is present tonight and can attest to the committee that the County Attorneys Association is also in favor of this adjustment.
Only if you want it, Mr. Chairman. He is here.
Representative Smith, I would like to have that on the record.
That's fine. Ms. Kingray.
Mr. Members, Chairman of Kingray, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingray, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. As we did last year, it represents our historic position. We and our board voted again this February to support this proposal. We believe it's about time to make those adjustments. I'm now going to make a statement that I can't back up and verify, but I believe these recommendations were also in the NEAC study, which came out in the late 90s, which made a number of criminal justice recommendations. I believe this was one of them, to increase those thresholds. But again, for some of the reasons stated previously, we do support this bill.
Representative Smith, is Mr. Sikora supposed to speak on this?
I think we'll let him identify himself for the record as well. Yes.
And just... be there for questions, is that it?
Yes, that's all. Mr. Chair and members, Robert Sikora, I work for the State Board of Public Defense, and I'm happy to respond to any questions that the committee has.
Representative Coles?
I'm sorry.
Representative Coles from my guest was on the list.
Representative Smith, I'm going to lobby a little bit of a softball here. I am a co-author on the bill. But, you know, if all of these nice new freshmen vote in favor of the bill, the first thing they're going to see is that Democrats want to let criminals out of jail sooner. I just want to make certain that this is going to continue to be a bipartisan issue and that we are not going to be lobbing hardball later.
I was in the snow. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, the answer is yes, this is a bipartisan effort, and I would defend to somebody's death your defense under that scurrilous attack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Somewhat the flippant response, but it's a nonsensical charge, and I know where you're coming from, and I believe you know where I am as well. So.
Well, Representative Smith, I think that may be where you stand, but I remember a certain Representative Knobloch being asked on the floor, and he had been the prior chair of the House Republican campaigns, and he was asked whether... a vote to re-refer without recommendation would be considered a vote for it. And his reply was, not here, but once we get out on the campaign trail, it will be.
I can't give you any assurance. This is the only campaign I'm allowed to run as my own.
Representative Biggin.
Just a quick question. So I guess a clarification for someone. Five-year felony with certain prior offenses, are those only the are those the property crime related offenses, or are they the general any other, like whether it's a drug or violent?
Mr. Hyatt.
Is it specified?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bingham, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're asking.
One of the things is five felonies with certain prior offenses is the current reads up to $500 would be a felony. You're proposing that it be between 500 and 1,000. I'm looking at the words to say with certain prior offenses.
I understand. Yes, under the current statutes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bingham, under the current statutes, if a person has prior theft-related offenses within the past several years, the threshold for them is lower. Right now, it's currently $250 is enough to get them into a felony level bracket. We're asking that $250 threshold be raised to $500, and that the threshold for a felony or for a property offense with no priors like that would be raised from $500 to $1,000.
Hey, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I haven't had a chance to chat with you about the bill yet, but to be honest, I've got some concerns at the lower end of the spectrum here. Probably greater concerns at the lower end of the spectrum than I do at the upper end. My sister-in-law happens to own a clothing store, and I'm concerned about some of these smaller crimes and the fact that now somebody can go into her store and steal $499 worth of clothing and is walking out of there if she is, he or she is caught with a misdemeanor offense. That seems to be a fairly big jump. I understand the issue at the higher end, honestly, I'm a little concerned about that. I hope that as this moves forward, I can at least chat with you about that. And I'm not sure if you're open to discussion about that, but I guess that is a concern that I have. I'm probably going to vote against the bill as it moves out of here, but hopefully we can work on it and be there. I can be there when we sign it.
Thank you.
Can you address that issue at all?
Sorry.
Why are we doing it at the lower end?
I'm going to address the person who is after me.
I will listen to the answer, and if I agree, I'll let you know.
Wait a second.
Okay. Mr. Hunter?
I'd be happy to try to field it, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sure there are some people who would like to see theft of any amount from their store made a felony-level offense. We just would ask the committee to recognize that inflation is a real factor here, and prices do continue to rise. Someone who is caught stealing less than $500 of merchandise will still be subject to a criminal penalty, up to 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine, probation, and any other conditions the court feels appropriate. There is a consequence still coming from this. We would just ask that they not be made a felon. That we believe is reserved for particularly serious crimes.
Representative Olin?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Smith and others. I was just going to clarify, I did bounce this off some retail business in northern Minnesota and also a couple county sheriffs in northern Minnesota, and they're not very excited about going quite that high. In fact, they weren't very excited of moving at all. They like the present law because they do have the shoplifters, et cetera, and the bad checks, et cetera, that they prosecute, and they were concerned about jumps.
And also, Representative, I have a question, but I'm not sure, are you?
I'm not, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith or Mr. Hunter is just looking at this, and it seems like the inflation rate, as I recall, since 87 is roughly about 65%, and yet we're going 100%. We're not really staying with the inflation rate, which you're indicating we should be going along with this because of the increase.
Mr. Chairman, there's a handout that's been provided to the committee, and hopefully you all have it. Looking at our analysis, we feel that the $1,000 threshold would be met by inflation as of 2009, so we're pretty close to that. Just looking at some consumer items, the price of gas in 1987 was $1.21 a gallon. It's now $2.39 or more. Bread was 90 cents back then. Now it's $2.10 on average. A half gallon of milk cost 95 cents back in 87, and it's now $2. It depends on the particular commodity that you're looking at, but inflation has roughly doubled in the last 20 years.
I was trying to go by the CPI.
Representative Bacon.
I was wishing that Representative Lesh was here. You know, not that I don't represent Minneapolis or St. Paul, but the question I would have is, there are cities that have actual municipal city attorneys, where, like, suburbs, I believe all of mine contract out with private firms. But is there any comment, or have you spoken to the cities of St. Paul or Minneapolis and how they plan to adopt the increase in caseload? Because usually how it's divided in the metro suburban areas is that felonies go to the county attorneys and then city attorneys take care of everything else. I was just wondering if you've spoken to the city attorneys from those cities.
Mr. Hunter? Mr. Hunter, you. Mr. Hunter.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. The bottom line here is that I don't believe that the city attorneys have weighed in specifically on this matter. Well, there would probably be an increased number of offenses prosecuted by their offices. These have to be dealt with somewhere, somehow. And ultimately, felonies do cost much more for the system to process, and we feel that ultimately this would be a cost-saving measure across the board.
Mr. Hunter, I think she had a legitimate question. What are we doing as a mandate on cities without funding it?
Mr. Chairman, can I short-circuit to answer here with Mr. Kingray that may be on point relative to city of
Denver? Mr. Kingray?
It's a brief answer. I'd like to offer to get it on the record.
Mr. Kingray?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and directly to the question I was just asked, many of our county attorneys do city attorney work, not only here in the metro area, but statewide as well. Many of them do city attorney work. Also on our board, we have as an ex officio member the president of the City Attorneys Association. He was at our board meeting last month when this issue was discussed. While he can't vote, he did indicate that he did not object to the position taken by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Board of Directors.
Okay, is there any further discussion? If not, the motion, Representative Smith renews his motion to pass and go to finance. Yes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's see. Okay. We're going to.
Representative Lesh, you will have a gavel tomorrow morning, so just sit tight.
Hey, John, it didn't work.
Now that we've gone through our fourth inning stretch, Mr. Chair, Representative. Chair Mullery, welcome again to your committee. And would you like to move House File 1242? And can you clarify for the committee what your motion might be?
Is there any money?
No.
There's no money. Okay. Mr. Chair, the motion would be just to lay it over for possible inclusion.
All right. Thank you, Chair Mullery. Why don't you proceed with your bill?
No. Okay. Since we're just going to lay it over, my witness just brought me the Senate file first engrossment, which is
which I would like to move as an amendment to the 1242 bill to get it in the shape that the author wants.
Chair Mueller, would you like to play just to make sure that the committee has your motion accurately? Would you like to move it as a delete all?
Yes.
And then
sorry, yes.
And adopt all the language from 1.5 to 1.20.
Yes.
So Representative Chair Mullery moves to delete all amendment to adopt the language in Senate file number 1340, first engrossment, lines 1.5 to 1.20.
Yes, Your
Honor. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, motion prevails. The bill is in the form that the author would like to have it. Proceed, Chair Mulready.
At the time the legislature approved the state takeover of public defense, the state and county were to reach an agreement on the details of the takeover, but no agreement was ever reached. And Hennepin is the only county in Minnesota to allocate property tax dollars to public defense. And in the feeling of Hennepin County Board, they've been shortchanged in allocating the appropriations. Hennepin's the only county required to pay its own Westlaw subscription. Hennepin required to pay operating expenses for all employees, both state and county, computers, software, printers, supplies. The state contribution to Hennepin's expenses has been frozen for the last 4 years, while the county contribution increased 11%. And the number and complexity of cases in the 4th Judicial District requires additional or adequate resources. Judicial initiatives and calendaring require unique staffing because of the types of cases. And the system will be greatly slowed down, increasing costs for the state through the courts and the county because they're sheriff and county attorneys. If the the Hennepin County is lacking in the resources for them. And Mr. Chairman, the witnesses, Mr. Rice, Brian Rice from Hennepin County.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Record.
My name is Brian Rice, and I'm here tonight representing the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. And thank you, Representative Mallory, for bringing this issue forward. I do have one other handout, if I can just have the committee here take a moment. Representative Mallory has moved as a study of this issue. It's a very vexatious issue involving quite a long history, and I know this committee has an awful lot of work to do tonight in this session. So what we've done is, Kevin Kyer from the Board of Public Defense is here. On the Senate side, we worked out some language rather than mandating any particular formula to undertake a study to look at this issue. But we do believe it's an important issue for the this committee, the Judiciary Committee, and the Finance Committee to look at. Hennepin County is the only county left in the state that is contributing property tax dollars to fund what in essence is a state responsibility under the Board of Public Defense, which is a branch of which is part of the judicial branch of government. There is a long history there. There are some reasons why the county perhaps should be contributing funds. The problem that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention is that in 98, when all new employees in the Public Defender's Office in Hennepin County were state employees, the county is contributing $4 million. Since then, that $4 million has increased to $6.5 million in this calendar year, a nearly a 50% increase in cost. And, you know, and the State Board of Public Defense, I think, has tried to work on these issues, but the county board year after year, rather than seeing its contribution either flat or decreasing, has seen it increase. Particularly, and this is a sad tale that I'm sure all the members of the legislature have heard, if you look at the years 2003 to 2004, you'll see a significant increase. You know, the explanation for that was what happened in the 2003 legislative session, where basically state budgets was balanced on the backs of local units of government. The county's contribution increased significantly then, and since then we've seen it creep up some more. For this year, Hennepin County has said that it would provide additional money beyond the $6.5 million that they're already doing in property tax, which, by the way, is 1% of the entire property tax levy in Hennepin County. The county has told its public defender, Leonard Castro, that it would provide an additional $450,000 in funding, but only if the state this time can come up with some new dollars to match it. We think it's an important local effort that Hennepin County is making, really, to fund state government in some level, and the board would like to see some resolution. We know this session has not had the resources to do it. We do think a study that's mandated that we can come back with, get the facts on the table and present it to the legislature this fall would be helpful to the committee to look at, and we'd hope, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Rice specifically? Representative Lush.
I have a question for Mr. Rice specifically. What does dextatious mean?
Vexatious.
Oh, it's vexatious. Okay, you said that. I didn't know what it meant.
Okay.
You're going to use that for your
vexatious? No, I clarified my speech. Does that help, Representative Lush?
Okay. No, actually.
Well, troublesome. Mr. Chair, Representative Lush.
Nice.
It's an issue that the county wrestles with every year. It puts state defenders, public defenders in Hennepin County in a difficult spot. Some of the employees are still considered county employees, some are state employees, I guess it's an issue that, it's a partnership issue that the board, would like the legislature to ruminate on.
Okay.
And more to the point, follow up there, Representative Lush.
Yes, please. Do you, Mr. Rice, do you know how much the State Board of Public Defense gets from the Hennepin County Attorney annually for appellate costs?
I do not.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lush, I do not.
Okay. Well, the reason I asked, just by way of comment, it is in excess of $10,000 to $15,000 for Adam, I believe, because currently as it stands, if the public defender appeals, both sides pay their own way. But if the city or the county appeals, they have to pay all of the costs for the public defender. So I just thought it was a teachable moment.
Thank you for that lesson, Representative Lush. Representative Thamar, thank you for your patience with Representative Lush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rice, just refresh my memory, because I was here when this issue first came up, and it seems to me that we wanted the county public defenders to go under the auspices of the State Board of Public Defense, and it was the county public defender's office and the county board who
refused.
Is that not correct?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, you're correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Rice? I believe we do have other testifiers as well.
Yes, I think you should.
Welcome again to the committee, Mr. Collier. State your name for the record.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Kevin Collier. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. So, Chairman, this is language that we agreed to with the folks from Hennepin County to do a study. I guess the only comment I would have is Representative Pena beat me to the punch on that one. And there is statutory language that calls for a cost sharing. So to characterize this as a short-changing, I think maybe a little bit strong in terms of the wording. But we're happy to sit down with the folks at Hennepin County and see if we can't come back to you next year with some kind of solution to this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Collier. Any questions specifically for Mr. Collier? Chair Mullery, anything you'd like to add? Anyone else? Excuse me. Bad habit. Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? Chair Mullery renews his motion to lay over 1242, so I will actually lay over House Call 1242 for the committee bill. As amended. Thank you. Representative Abler, welcome to the committee. It is your misfortune that I'm going to remain in the chair, but in spite of that...
Sir, I live dangerously, and this is just me.
Representative Abler, I understand that, that the bill is currently in Representative Thiessen's committee, and so this is, again, going to be an informational hearing.
I did a brief one. I mean, you can as brief as you want.
And, Representative Abler, you have 8 seconds go. No, two minutes for presentation.
We'll be very brief and you can ask those questions.
Great.
I think part of the procedure, you want to see it with a little more formality.
Great. Thank you, Representative Abler. Why don't you go ahead and
explain it in brief and
proceed.
And what you care about are the privacy issues and the penalties. Is that right?
If we could really focus on, actually, I'm looking for House File 1041.
This is the famous Nassberg bill, famous at least in very small circles. The point of this bill is to give physicians who are prescribing Vicodin and Schedule 2 and 3 medications, which are pain meds, which are narcotics, the chance to know what is happening in the past with their people and see what's given to them so they don't get trapped into giving out too much. As you're aware, Vicodin and OxyContin abuse is a great issue. That's the summary. And so this creates a website that people can go to, the doctor or the pharmacist can look it up. We've dealt with a lot of the issues. The data will be encrypted, so the doctor will not be identifiable. The Board of Pharmacy will be managing it, and they'll have the key, which they'll give out only upon subpoena, or court order, I think it is. The bill that you see in front of you is going to be amended to include Schedule 2. It'll be Schedule 2 and 3. There'll be a photo ID required. Whoever buys Schedule 2 and 3, just to make sure you're not Mary Johnson, your card says you're Mary Smith. And if you don't have that, it's sort of be a way to secure some of the abuse. The Board of Medicine can't use the data for professional discipline. And the Board of Medical Practice is doing some extra training. And we're excluding the people who have obviously no chance to abuse, people in hospital, people in assisted living, so that they're administered. And then where the health plans are required to do more tracking of this in their own work, as is the DHS. The data is limited up to 6 months. And it can't be used for a criminal process except without in a bona fide criminal process, not just a fishing expedition. And I believe that's the heart of the bill. And maybe you want to ask us a question. Do you want to describe the website? Is that
well, I, actually, the testifier could introduce himself to the committee. And
I'm Dr. Thomas Cohn. I work with medical advanced pain specialists. I'm a pain practitioner. I've been in practice for almost 20 years. We're bringing NASPARG to Minnesota. It's the National Prescription Drug Monitoring in legislation that was passed on a national basis in 2005, and it establishes a data bank system on an individual state basis such that physicians can track scheduled prescriptions so that we can determine if someone is trying to divert getting multiple prescriptions, and it allows us to have the comfort to prescribe to those who need the medication and also to be aware of someone who may need clinical dependency treatment. The data bank has been enacted in 30 states. We're trying to not be the last one, so we're not going to attract all the people who are going to want to divert to our state. And
you could kind of focus on the penalties and the data
should be limited to access to the physician who is prescribing, the pharmacist who is checking the individual patient's prescription, and the patient. Those are the only three people who have real any amount of access to it. The data bank also the Board of Pharmacy, because they're going to be constructing this, the database, will have individual access to it, but they won't be looking in it. There'll be the coordinated company will be computer company will be coordinating it, but they won't be looking at the database. And the only way to get at that database is for law enforcement is with the bona fide subpoena. We don't anticipate law enforcement looking at this database because when law enforcement looks for information, they can go through the DEA process, so there's no reason for them to want to go into this database.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Any questions for Representative Abler or for Dr. Cohen? Representative Holbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand this is informational only. Is that
right,
correct?
That is correct.
Will there be an ability to audit access to the system so that if an individual is concerned who was accessing their records, there would be a trail of that?
Representative Abler, Dr. Cohen?
I would anticipate that when someone enters, they have to have an ID to enter it, so they'll be able to, and there will be a central bank of who what those IDs are. So I assume the Board of Pharmacy will know in the computer, it won't be active that someone's checking it, and there will only be a reason if there's a criminal investigation who acts to access it when and why.
And this, Mr. Chair, so are you building the system from the ground up, or are you using one that's already done? Or?
Dr. Cohen.
There are 30 states who have prescription monitoring programs. We would probably use those as our model. And that's what I anticipate the Board of Pharmacy will be setting it up and we will use.
I would hope that if this moves forward in any way, that you would make sure that an individual would have the ability to know who has looked up information on them as part of the system. So see, they have that accountability factor there.
Thank you, Representative Holberg, and welcome to the committee. And state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tara Garman. I represent the Medical Advanced Pain Clinic. As of now, there is federal funding for this, and there's federal funding to do implementation, planning, and then enhancement. It would be in the planning stage, so we do know it just passed Senate Judiciary today, and we'll be going into Berglund's health finance bill. So we do anticipate that there's going to be some more things that we'll be putting into the planning, and the audit would be something that we can definitely look at and deal with for Jim's bill.
Thank you, Ms. Garman.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler.
Yeah, more stuff to think of. Mr. Neumeister has a few thoughts, and she'll propose a few extra questions.
Thank you, Representative. I think we'll deal with Representative Coles and his questions first, and any others before Mr. Neumeier? Neumeister, I can't remember. Neumeister comes to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, could you describe for me again? I'm sure it was said, and with all the paper flying around, I missed it. Can you give me again the simple why? We're trying to create this database. Help me understand that, please.
Dr. Cohen.
This is Dr. Cohen. This comes from the large number of prescription diversions that we know that is going on. In 2002, the GAO, the federal government, realized that illegal diversion is a major, major problem. Just to give you an idea, in Minnesota, I'll give you the figures, 4% of narcotic prescriptions are felt to be used for non-medical purposes. And this is from 2005 U.S. Department of Health statistics. So that's a huge number of prescriptions that are being used in Minnesota for non-medical purposes. And we know that Vicodin and OxyContin and any number of narcotic prescriptions are getting onto the street by diversion from any number of methods. And what we're trying to do is reduce that rate of diversion. In the states that have enacted prescription monitoring programs, they found that the rate of diversion has dropped 90%. As a pain specialist, we're writing in our practice probably over 100 prescriptions a day, probably 200 prescriptions a day because of the number of practitioners in our practice, and 4% is a huge number of prescriptions that are being diverted, if you think about that, and a huge number of medications, and we want to reduce that number for public safety reasons.
Representative Cole.
So that begs the next question, and help me understand how this will do that. I think you talked about law enforcement not having access to this. So how will this system, how will this monitoring get us to that reduction, which is absolutely a wonderful goal that I support?
It will allow us to realize who's for real for patients and who's coming to us. If a patient comes to me and I write a prescription, I can look into this data bank and see if they've received prescriptions from 10 other physicians or 10 other places within the last month. Currently, there is no linking of databases. Mm-hmm. Medicare has a database, Blue Cross has a database, Medicaid has a database, Workman's Comp has a database, Cash does not have any database, insurance, auto insurance doesn't have any database, and people can go through all these different sources and get prescriptions, and they can do it all at one time, and we have no way of picking this up. With a database, all these prescriptions will be entered, and we can take a look in one place, find out if a person has 10 prescriptions, and then decide this person is going to 10 different doctors, this person needs help and needs drug treatment.
One last
Representative Coles.
One last question, Mr. Chair. Doctor, as a physician, I understand that you would have access to this system. If you see that somebody is abusing one of these narcotics, or appears to be abusing one of these narcotics, do you have, under current law or under your obligations as a physician, any duty or requirement to report to law enforcement, and how would this change that, if at all?
Mr. Cohen.
We don't have any requirement to report a person to law enforcement. Our medical duty is to help this person get medical treatment for their what we assume is abuse of medications.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
Welcome. Ms. Garman, I understand you want to add.
Sorry, it's Erickson now. That's okay.
I'll just point out that the witnesses oversight. Congratulations.
I just did want to say one thing is that we had an ER doctor from North Memorial testify today, doctors periodically get lists sent to them by one of the plans, and she said that this wasn't a very bad list, and it was from one patient, and it had over 30 doctor visits who had been to ERs from all over about a 60-mile radius in less than 5 months. We're talking over 30 prescriptions that had been used. Her major concern is they feel like they are under-treating patients because they don't know who's legitimate anymore and who isn't. That is their major concern. They want to be prescribing these medications to the people that actually need them and not to people who don't. And if they feel like they have this database to look at, then they would that would control what was happening.
Representative Bingham.
Just more of a comment. I know that kind of what I was wondering is if there's something with methamphetamine, you know, there's an issue where a person can go from store to store to store and not be able to be tracked at what they've purchased. And I was just wondering if there are any plans to expand this to, I know this is more of a physician's thing, that's why, but, or maybe it could be used as some sort of pilot for that to expand on the wonderful legislation that was passed a few years ago. But it was more of a comment, not really a question, but if you want to respond.
I would love to be able to do that. But first, I want to get this bill passed. This is the first step. What we have found is once we control narcotics, those other illegal drugs do, that use does go up. So it may be an important step in the future, but we really needed to concentrate on the first step.
I was just going to make that point, and it's they're both just very important issues that deserve attention, and I think I'm going to be signing on to this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Dr. Cohen and Ms. Erickson. And Mr. Neumeister, would you like to address the committee? Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record if you're
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I oppose this bill as is. I've shared my concerns in terms of possible amendments. They haven't been officially adopted. Let me go into the bill. First of all, the statement, build and they will come. I've seen this for so many times over the legislature. Build a database, put more things in, and then you'll have all kinds. This is the first time we're going to have electronic record keeping for prescriptions. And Mr. Chairman, as Representative Bingham indicated, already, if this was in place 3 years ago, everyone who probably wanted to buy a non-prescription drug or Sudafed would probably be on this computer. So from that point of view, I'll share with you some things that you might want to think about when this bill becomes before your committee. At least in terms of privacy interest, I think it's important of this prescription electronic reporting advisory board, it should not be made. They shall meet. And one of the things that this committee may know about was CRIMNet. It has an active group of citizens and all kinds of people trying to put together policies. And they've been attentive. Mr. Chairman, a member of your committee, Ms. Holberg, has been very active. Mr. Cornish has been very active on that, just so they could share some insight, too, in that regard. Further on page 2. Now, I don't know if Representative Abler told you about the Board of Medical Practices amendment that may go on, and I don't know what the status of the bill, but it basically doesn't allow doctors to be reviewed or whatever about their prescriptions. But one of the things that I have some trouble with is that if you look on page 3, lines 313 through 316, individuals receiving prescriptions on line 14, it says to obtain controlled substances in quantities or 315 frequently inconsistent. So the Board of Pharmacy is looking at individuals, patients, and they're making a decision. Once they make that decision, is that data going to be shared with somewhere else or whatever? Now, they also may know what the doctor is doing. So if they see that inconsistency or whatever the doctor, the proposed amendment protects doctors, but would it protect the individual patient if they see something wrong in that regard? Further, if you go on page 4, lines 4 and 5, this is where you'll see where the board, members of the staff, will have these duties and responsibilities. So that's one of the issues. How do they report if they see any of these infrequencies or whatever? Second, I mean, the next item, and this is a personal thing, but on lines 415 through 418, who do we do guinea pig tests on generally? This is a personal opinion, because my parents were on welfare, my dad was a disabled vet, and I've seen legislation. Because people get aid from government, we're going to have folks, medical assistance program, if they see some kind of habit or infrequency or whatever, they're going to control their behavior. But how about the people outside of that may have the same issue? We don't control them.
Mr. Neumeister, just to give you a fair warning, just a couple more minutes and then we'll have to move on. But proceeding, just a quick reminder to that the bill's before us for the disciplinary action section, subdivision, and then also the data issues. But you're on point. Just want to keep you on point. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Continue.
On page 413, 414, and then 429 and 430, it's important that search warrant be very clear. So anyone in law enforcement, they have to do it with a search warrant. Secondly, and the last one is on 432, it talks about a valid search warrant, but it brings up the issue of a court order. What kind of court order could be issued to get some of these names? Whether it be for a doctor, whether it be for the individual patient or the dispenser. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is new stuff. I encourage you to look at the privacy interests of this bill thoroughly when the bill comes up to you next week. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And any other questions from the committee? Representative, just a quick question for you as the author. When is the bill being heard in
Representative?
Monday at 8. And then what would you like this committee to do when the bill comes before us? To General Register?
I believe that's
going to be General Register. Or will we lay it over for corporation and our data practices? Okay. Okay. But we will. My understanding is that just for your information, we will lay over the data practices section for possible inclusion in our data practices bill, and then but still send the bill on to and then we'll people will take smorgasbord with the bill. Thank you, Representative Abram.
Members, Ms. Garvin if there's any question about needing help on crime in our district, Ms. Garvin could testify to that, right?
I said if there's any question about needing help for crime in our district, Ms. Garvin could give a litany of, unfortunately, she's... Unfortunately, she is moving on. Representative Fulford,
sir, could you just kind of maybe bring us up to date of what bills we have left to consider tonight, especially which ones were laid over this morning, if we're still hear any of those, or...
The ones that we have left are... We've got 1621, 211... 34 and 611. With that 611, I just am calling up right now. We're trying to shift the authors in, and we promised to take him up now.
And then, Mr. Charity, the ones from this morning, Representative Paymar's airport bill. Or?
Representative Holberg, he requested that be continued till Monday, and we did that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ansels, you're back up, and we've heard we've got Representative Zellers now too. Well, you'll be next. Representative Ansels, we've heard your testimony, and we've just gotten to the discussion period. So, and I'm not sure how many amendments or discussion there will be, but we'll set a 15-minute limit on discussion, amendments, and questions. So, as I recall, there were some amendments, four amendments. So, but the roll call does count towards that. So, the discussion should be shortened some if each one's going to be a roll call. But, okay, members, so we would start that.
Get him out.
Representative Ansels, I think we all remember your bill. Did you want to have a couple minutes to refresh people's memory about it? Or?
Well, thank you.
I will give you a couple minutes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Just for starters, I don't see anything humorous in anything that's happened here yet this evening.
Pardon?
That's funny.
That was humorous.
Maybe Zellers is here.
Why don't you move another bill in that
So we left. Is Zellers still in?
Zellers is moving too.
He's going to be downstairs. You want to go vote on teacher health plan? Because that's where he's going.
There's still a bill.
Oh, that here. Is.
Why don't we just
do it?
Let's see. I think we'll.
Here?
Yes, I was just going to call that one up. It's number 34. And Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, I think there's. Let's set 7 minutes for o'clock, the testimony 4 and 7 minutes, and then I'll extend it to 20 minutes for the committee to, it usually is 15 minutes, but I think there's some amendments, aren't there?
Mr. Chairman, you're looking at me. There might be a couple.
No. Representative Kahn, we'll extend the discussion. We have a period. We've lumped them together, discussion, amendments, and questions. Mm-hmm. And so we'll set 20 minutes for that. So you and the opponents will have 7 minutes, and the opponents should get together and see how they want to present it, and I assume you can organize whoever you want. Oh, yourself? Okay. Everybody, okay, we would, okay, Representative Kahn, does somebody want to move? Representative Kahn? Representative Tamar moves Representative Kahn's bill, and this would be, does this go to the floor directly then? Okay, then Representative Paymar moves House File 34 for passage and referral to the General Register. Go ahead, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much. I do have one amendment that I've given you for the section of the bill that you are intending to consider. The bill, Mr. Chairman, has gone through two committees. I think most people on the committee know what the bill is about. What the bill is to do is to set a stem cell research policy for the state of Minnesota. It does not have appropriations in it, but the reason it's important to say that the state funds can be spent on stem cell research is the mess we've gotten into with the restriction on federal funds, which means that places have to keep not just two sets of books, but separate buildings, separate pipette cases, separate boxes of pens and so forth for the different kind of research that we're doing. The importance of this is that what this bill is not is embryonic stem cell research is not the equivalent of abortion, except in some very limited religious interpretation. So what we are saying is that and I did not believe previous committees. I've had people from the advocacy groups, from the Parkinson's Foundation, people talking about ALS, people talking about the effect on multiple sclerosis. I've also brought the researcher from the University of Minnesota to explain what she does. I decided that your time was more important at this point. So, I want to emphasize that there is nothing in this bill that would ever destroy a potential life. And this is essentially, and in fact, what we're doing is we're taking what has been called remaining embryos under most places, that the embryos that are left over from in vitro fertilization, and using them in experiments that would end up enhancing life. Scientists widely consider this to be the most exciting, far-reaching part of scientific biological research. It will be done somewhere. If it's not done in the state of Minnesota, it will be outsourced, and I think the point is we should do it here with public scrutiny, and we should not outsource the most exciting piece of science to come along. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you have the amendment. It's to
Representative Kahn, I believe yours is the A13, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Kahn, I believe Representative Paymar then moves your 813 amendment to get it in the shape that the author wants. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All in favor of moving the 813? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, can she explain what the amendment means?
Well,
Representative Holbert, the standard is usually we accept the amendment to put in where the author, and then
What happens is that this is one of the things to make people more comfortable about what we were doing, was to make sure that this bill was not going to outlaw cloning. And so the language that we took, which I didn't make up, came from both the law that exists in New Jersey and also from the initiative that was passed by in Missouri this year. And so what? So if you're looking at the last lines 213 to 217, that specifically adds the penalty from the New Jersey law on the cloning of a human being, even though there's no intention that that would ever be done. It was put there to enhance the comfort level. What this does is to make sure that cloning doesn't cover in vitro fertilization. We understand what we know what cloning is. You take a cell from a person, and this is what was understood in Washington. You take a cell, and then you make that cell then becomes a new human being. But, you know, we could have a whole legislature of Mary Lou Holbert.
I mean, frankly, I was thinking a whole legislature.
So anyway, all the language that I'm adding means is that something that's developed from the fertilization of the egg of a female by the sperm of a human male, i.e. in vitro fertilization, is not outlawed by this. It is, by what you understand the definition of cloning is, this kind of further defines cloning by saying what it isn't. And this language comes from the Missouri initiative.
Can we go ahead and put it in the form that the author wants? Okay, then all in favor of the A13 amendment to put it in the form the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Okay, then it's in the form the author wants. Do you want to... You've got a few minutes so you can...
I just couldn't let it go to other people. I think I'll just say the penalty section comes from the penalty section comes with the first penalty part comes from the same section of the statute that we put it in 145, which is similar to the penalties we have against doing fetal research, which was passed in 1973. I don't think it's ever been invoked, and then the additional penalty on cloning was taken from this New Jersey and Missouri.
Okay, thank you. Then the opponents, do you want to come up? Is there one presentation? And then please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good evening. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization which consists of over 77,000 member families and over 240 chapters across Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to speak here tonight in opposition to House File 34. Since MCCL's beginning in 1968, its mission has been to protect and defend innocent life from the time of conception to natural death. I have been asked to keep my comments to the penalties provisions in the bill, so while I have much more to say, I will hold my comments to those areas. First, I would like to discuss Section 2, Subdivision 3C of the bill. This language was added at the end of the last committee hearing, so the public has not previously had an opportunity to testify on the subject area. I would like to be certain that everyone here today understands exactly what it would require to commit a felony under this bill, and perhaps, more importantly, what one would be allowed to do without committing a felony under this bill. Section 2, Subdivision 3C, bans cloning as defined by Representative Kahn, specifically a replicated human individual that has developed through the egg, embryo, fetal, and newborn stage. That means one could go through the process of cloning a human individual. They could cultivate this new life through the egg, embryo, and fetal stages, and so long as they kill the clone at any point before it is born, they could avoid felony charges. This appears to turn justice on its head. Most people would consider it a crime to kill an innocent human life, but Representative Kahn's bill would make it a felony not to kill this new life. What we are talking about here is explicitly allowing the creation of human clones, not just for research, but to harvest it for them for their parts. If that is not the intent, I would encourage the author of the bill and the University of Minnesota to explain their intent and to justify why they need clones that have developed through the fetal stage. Without a justification, we are led to believe that the University of Minnesota scientists and the University of Minnesota intend, or at least want to make sure that it is legal, to clone human beings through the fetal stage, then kill or abort, not sure what the proper term is, maybe destroy and dissect them before their birth, and claim they are not engaging in human cloning. Second, it appears that the gross misdemeanor penalties established in Section 2, Subdivision 3B are either redundant or in conflict with Minnesota Statute 145.4422. Statute 145.422 prohibits, quote, use of a living human conceptus for any type of scientific, laboratory research, or other experimentation, except to protect the life or health of the conceptus, end quote. The difference between House File 34 and 145.422 seems to be that House File 34 makes it explicit that the embryo destructive research already being done at the University of Minnesota is allowed, as well as the cloning that the university may be attempting or plans to attempt in the future. The university already claims it may do this research, that its actions are not in conflict with 145.422. Today, I ask, if it is legal to do that research, then there are no legal bans on using state funding for it. And from what I can see, there is no reason to pass this bill, unless, of course, the research that the university is doing is in conflict with 145.422. This question has been raised in previous committees, and the University of Minnesota scientists and the author of the bill have merely said that it doesn't conflict and have essentially refused to provide any further explanation. The citizens of the state of Minnesota deserve a better answer, an explanation of how destroying human embryos for their stem cells does not conflict with the existing ban on destroying innocent human life for research. On behalf of MCCL and the tens of thousands of Minnesota citizens that we represent, I would urge the committee to oppose House File 34 and the outrageous destruction of human life that will follow from it. And one last brief comment is that I would like to note that while Representative Kahn stated that what this bill does is allow us to do research on the so-called leftover embryos from in vitro fertilization, there is nothing in this legislation that limits it to that, to using only those embryos. In fact, if you look on line 1.12, it states that embryos from any source can be used. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Then, Representative, oh, is there another?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to come up? Because there's a few minutes. There's about 2 minutes left.
Is that I understand. I ask the forbearance of the chair, given that this is the second appearing for this, and that we have heard a long discussion on a couple of other bills, so I'd ask your forbearance. I'm Kirk Allison, and I'd just like to enter a correction of the agenda of March 8th in terms of my name and spelling. I am the director of the Program in Human Rights and Health at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. I am also the chair-elect of the Ethics Forum of the American Public Health Association. Chair Mullery, Ranking Member Coles, and distinguished committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to address you on House File 34. I'm speaking, as is always the case, for myself. In prior committees, I've articulated several defects in the current bill and possible consequences in the social context, including for patient safety, and I've given a list, and one can refer to those later. While all of these are of import and of general concern, the focus of House File 34 in this committee has been stipulated to be Subdivision 3, focusing on penalties. It is titled Prohibiting Sale of Fetal Tissue Cloning of Human Beings. The latter element was added during the Workforce Policy and Higher Education Division No, I'd like to address the penalty sections and some models that we have in state and national legislation and some issues on terminology, which Representative Kahn represented as being accurate on cloning, but which in fact are scientifically inaccurate. Subdivision 3, penalties for 3B, provides for the attachment of unspecified penalties for a gross misdemeanor should a person knowingly, for valuable consideration, purchase, sell, or otherwise transfer, obtain, or promote the sale or transfer of embryonic or cadaveric fetal tissue for research purposes. Penalties should be attached to such behavior, I agree. For example, New Jersey Statute 26-2Z-2 states, public policy relative to derivation of use of certain cells of human and stipulates a fine up to $50,000 for each violation under valuable consideration as a crime of the third degree. New Jersey has a rather odd classification of offenses, but that's roughly along gross misdemeanor to felony level of offense. This is an automatically enhanceable augmented penalty, as should be the case in Minnesota. It should be noted that in the realm of tissue processing and storage, what makes reasonable payment versus valuable consideration an issue is not always clear. What is $30,000 as reasonable payment or valuable consideration? That's a general comment in terms of the difficulties of regulating this area. Now, Subdivision 3C states cloning of human being, which derives from New Jersey Statute 2C111A, and it restates this and perpetuates its defects. And I've provided the text of the New Jersey statute. I discussed the New Jersey statute with the bill's author, Representative Kahn, on February 6th, and noted that it was, one, scientifically inaccurate, two, publicly misleading, and three, lacks coherence from a regulative point of view, unless the latter goal is to keep open a possibility of gestating human life in utero up to the point of birth for utilitarian harvesting of organs. Now, the prohibiting of human cloning is inaccurate and misleading as it appears in lines 2.4 and 2.5. The title indicates a ban on human cloning, but scientifically speaking, it does not ban human cloning. It stipulates that what makes a clone is live birth, not genetic replication, and this is patently false. And Representative Kahn represented cloning as being live birth, and I'd like to indicate this compendium of the February 26th conference, Creating Stem Cells by Research Cloning at the University of Minnesota, at which both Representative Kahn and I attended, that indicates that research cloning, not replication to live birth, is cloning. So the first thing that I would say as a friendly suggestion, because I can't offer amendments, is to change cloning of a human being to reproductive cloning of a human being, and to explicitly include gestational limits present in statutes such as Minnesota Statute 145-421-2. Secondly, one should note that in this statute, as described in the definition of cloning, it indicates that birth is required to be recognized as a human individual in Minnesota, and this is inconsistent with Minnesota Statute 609-266 concerning crimes against unborn children. In other words, one need not be a born individual to be recognized as an individual in Minnesota law. Now, for penalties under 3C, concerning what I would call reproductive cloning, there's some examples. One is presented by Senator Dianne Feinstein in the Human Cloning Ban Act of 2005. It proposed a substantial criminal and civil penalties for reproductive cloning and a mandatory fine of minimally $1 million and imprisonment of up to 10 years, plus forfeiture of property involved in the offense. And she defines human cloning in her bill as the term human cloning means implanting or attempting to implant the product of nuclear transplantation into a uterus or the functional equivalent of a uterus, not live birth, but implantation. Now, there's clearly some difficulties here with the science, and the science difficulty is that replication, not implantation, not live birth, is what makes a clone, and I'm racing to the end. The imprisonment clause is important, I believe, because it prevents an individual from escaping a count should a well-financed source be willing to pay the civil penalty. In Canada, there's a similar statute, 10 years imprisonment or $500,000 Canadian. Finally, again,
Mr. Allison, you have reached a full time of the entire side, and so we'll give you one more minute on that. We didn't extend any testimony from people tonight. There was a couple times, I believe, when members had questions that we allow the answers. You've got about 1 minute, and we're going to wrap it up then.
I'll wrap it up and give my colleague a second to speak of that. But I would just urge, clarity of definitions and appropriate penalties to be invoked. And the reason why is because the public interest is served best when the science is clear, not when it's stated in a misleading way, as it is in this bill. And I apologize for overrunning my time, and I thank you for your attention.
Okay, then the period is now open. Representative Rush, did you want to... You were first on the list.
I had a question from the
questions.
My question was, and I was worried about, because the organization supports the protection of life from conception and natural death. And one of the things I'm confused about, because I've never been in a committee where we have this kind of debate, and I haven't been part of the discussion like this before, is when I was in college, I went to a lab where they grew big sheets of skin for skin grafts for burn victims. And it was human skin, human cells, and they were technically alive, live cells. Does your organization put that in the same category? Like, is that something that you want to protect? Is that destruction of human life?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, no, we would not. Our protection, what we view is human individuals. Not particular cells, but actual individual.
Okay, and maybe I shouldn't ask this question. That would be rhetorical, I suppose. No, thank you.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I have two questions for Representative Kahn, if we're at that point, but if not...
No, Representative Coles, we started about a minute and a half ago with question and answer. Don't want to cut short the amendments, so I'm trying to shorten
Representative, Representative Kahn, has the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota endorsed House File 34?
Representative Kahn?
No, they have not been asked.
And Representative Kahn, can you tell us, do you know whether, I think it's a representative from the university here, I hope we don't have to call him up, but do you know whether the bill is a part of the university's legislative agenda for the 2007 legislative session?
No.
Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can move on to amendments.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, I have a question for Representative Kahn.
Okay, but this is all cutting into, if you have a lot of amendments, but Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, the testimony that I heard from maybe Ms. Rao or somebody, or maybe it was the other gentleman, is it true that we wouldn't need this legislation if, in fact, the university were conducting legal research right now?
Representative Kahn?
The university is conducting legal research right now. The issue is to put the university to put the state of Minnesota clearly in the same position as 8 other states in the country have of saying that the state affirmatively supports stem cell research. Because the other states have already lost people who are doing research in this area because of the fear of legislation or the fear of interference with government. In fact, the initiative for the Missouri, the reason behind the Missouri initiative was to clearly show that the people of Missouri, a much more conservative state than Minnesota, I'll point out, supported stem cell research despite the kind of initiatives that were being presented in the legislature. So it was to make that as a clear and definitive statement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Quickly, Mr. Chair, the problem, Representative Kahn, is I'm in Minnesota, I'm not in Missouri, and I believe that you've had this question in the other two committees, and I'm interested to hear on the record again how you believe that conducting any research on human embryos isn't a violation of current statute 145.421.
I'm the only person in this room who was here when 145.121 was passed, and if you read through 145.121, you see that it specifically refers to every sign of life that it refers to the late stages of fetal and embryo development. Nothing to do with stem cells, which are taken in the first 5 days after fertilization.
Representative Holbrook, this is...
I know.
If you have a lot of amendments, we're going to get to them.
I've read the A13 amendment like 10 times, and I'm hoping I'm going to get an answer with words less than 5 syllables in length. But I'm not understanding, and this is, I'm sorry if I'm going to appear ignorant here, how you get a cell with genetic material that wasn't ultimately the product of the fertilization of the egg of a female and the sperm of a human male?
By cloning it. I mean, if you take the, you know, the process of cloning is stimulating a cell which has not been which has not been formed in that way, and then making it into a clone.
But I mean, the way I'm looking at it is, where did that cell that you're cultivating come from?
Well, the product, Mr. Chairman, the product of the fertilization of the egg of the human female by the sperm of the human male is talking about that exact act.
So it's not, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, so it's not modifying the genetic material on line 216. I mean, what I'm trying to figure out here is, take one of my cells, but ultimately I came from an act of fertilization. I don't know if this is a chicken and egg question, or if I'm just dancing, but I'm not understanding how your language doesn't cover everything, because everything...
The thing that you're modifying is a cell with genetic material, other than the product of, so that initial cell is the product of the fertilization of the egg of the human female by the sperm of the human male.
Okay, and where do you get those initial cells from? Don't you get them from humans?
The replication.
Representative Connor.
You don't get it from the product of the fertilization of the egg of a human female by the sperm of a human male.
But aren't all humans the product of the fertilization?
If you want to make the temporal part completely clear, then you could, in front of product, write the immediate product.
Oh, I'm just, it's not making sense to me, and like I said, I may be real dense on this. And
Representative Holbrook, I've been told that you have a number of amendments.
I know, and I'm sorry, but like I said, I've read this number 10 times, and I just can't separate any cell that has human genetic material not coming from the product of fertilization.
Representative Holbrook, if your side has amendments,
I know, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'll just give it up.
Does somebody want to offer an amendment?
Sure, I will offer the E6.
Representative Emmer offers the A6 amendment.
I offer the A6 amendment. It's very simple. Page 1, line 1.7. And it relates, by the way, Mr. Chairman, to the penalty section, because we're talking about the type of stem cell research. It simply inserts the word adult before stem cell on line 1.7. And the purpose for this is, we have a statute, contrary to Representative Kahn's interpretation, that is very clear. We do not allow, in the state of Minnesota, based on the 1973 law that I cited earlier, we don't allow this type of activity. It's illegal to be doing research on human conceptus, which means any human organism conceived either in the human body or produced in an artificial environment other than the human body, from fertilization through the first 265 days thereafter. So it's illegal to do this. Let's not make a bad bill worse. And I ask you please support the E6th Amendment, and I ask for a roll call.
Okay, we'll go to the roll call right away.
Well,
Representative Conn?
I would just say vote no. That takes away the whole purpose of the bill.
Okay. Chair will call the roll.
Chair Mallory?
No.
Representative Bigham?
No.
Representative Cornish? Representative DeLaForest?
Aye.
Representative Emmert?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hoberg?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kalin?
No.
Representative Coles?
Yes.
Representative Kranz? Representative Lesh? Representative Lilly? Representative Olin?
Yes.
Representative Paymar?
No.
Representative Saylor?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Westrum?
Bill 68.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A9 amendment.
Representative, who's the A9? Do we have an
Mr. Chair, I think the A9 is being passed out. I'll move the A12, which I believe has been passed out.
Thank you, Representative Coles and Representative.
I'll withdraw the A9 until it's passed out.
Representative Coles, could you state your amendments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A12 amendment would delete the definition of cloning of a human being in House File 34 and replace it with the language on line 1.3 and line 1.4. I'm incredibly concerned about the language in Representative Kahn's bill and the testimony that we heard, and what is clear from the language in the bill as it currently stands is that cloning is permissible under this bill up until the point that the child is born. What the amendment would do is it would outlaw cloning and define a human person, a human being, as the physical state wherein the DNA of mankind is joined. It would prohibit cloning, which I believe Representative Kahn said she doesn't support. But her bill currently allows for cloning until the child is born. With that, I'd move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Roll call. Mm-hmm.
And ask for a roll call.
Thank you. Representative Kahn, you just want to state your position in one word yourself?
In other words, this makes no sense. This language of saying we're in the DNA of mankind is joined, I don't understand what that means at all.
Thank you.
No sense.
Thank you. And we don't understand Representative Connors.
Chairman Mallory.
No.
Representative Bigham.
No.
Representative Cornish. Representative DeLaForest.
Yes.
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kalin?
No.
Representative Coles?
Yes.
Representative Kranz? Representative Lesh? Representative Lilly? Representative Olin?
Yes.
Representative Paymar?
No.
Representative Saylor?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Westrum?
Fails 6-8. There's an A8 amendment.
Actually, I'm moving the A9.
We have
it. It should have been passed out before the A8. The A9 amendment applies to page 1, line 19. It removes the term with timely, replaces it with at least 24 hours in advance with. This has to do with the physician who is treating a patient for infertility shall provide at least 24 hours within at least 24 hours appropriate information sufficient to allow the patient to make informed and voluntary choices regarding the disposition of any human embryos. And I just referenced the witness that testified. There should be more definition. I think that with timely is way too vague. So I offer the 24-hour Amendment A9, and I ask for a roll call.
Representative Conn, I assume you oppose it? Or?
Yes, I oppose the amendment, and I have talked to people from the Fertility Institute, and their timing is much longer than this. They work months in advance. They do frozen embryos that are sometimes there for years in advance. We're not 24 hours. It's totally meaningless time.
Okay, we'll go through the clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Mallory.
No.
Representative Pickham.
No.
Representative Cornish. Representative De La Forest.
Yes.
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
No.
Representative Coles.
Yes.
Representative Kranz. Representative Lesh. Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Olin.
Yes.
Representative Kamer.
No.
Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Westrum.
Fails 6-9. I see an A8 amendment.
I move the A8 amendment.
Representative Member Emmer moves the A8
amendment. Very quickly, this applies to the same section, and again, it's just trying to be a little bit more definitive. At the infertility clinic, they are not treating a patient. They are treating a couple, and then they are not providing a patient. They are providing a female with timely and relevant appropriate information. So this simply clarifies who it is we're addressing, and I'd ask for your support and ask again for a roll call.
That's not true. Again, I've spoken to people at the infertility clinic, and they very often treat single people. They very often, the consent of the male is absolutely required by court cases, and it's also in violation of university policy and state law.
The clerk will call the roll.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was there a hand up?
Yeah, yeah, right here.
Oh,
by Representative Conn, could you please be more definitive about what university policy is being violated?
Yeah, university policy has policies against sexual discrimination and also against marital status discrimination and whatever.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Conn, I'll have you know that this was taken out of current statute, these terms. So with that, I'd ask for your support. This is actually taken out of the law, so it's consistent with our current statutes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Clerk will call the roll.
Chairman Mallory.
No.
Representative Bigham.
Yep.
Representative Cornish. Representative De La Forest.
Yes.
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
Yes.
Representative Coles.
Yes.
Representative Kranz. Representative Lesh. Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Olin.
Yes.
Representative Tamer. Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Westrum.
Bill 78. Bill 78. Seeing no further amendments, and since we're over the time, we will now vote on, was it Representative Tamer's motion to pass it to the register?
Roll call.
Ms. Benson is doing such a nice job. We gotta do it one more time. Thank you. Before we take the roll, I would like to thank you for allowing us the opportunity to offer the amendments. I appreciate that on behalf of the members on my side of the aisle. It's much appreciated and well noted.
Thank you, Representative Coles, and I want to thank both sides of the aisle for keeping it real clean and respecting each other tonight. So we call the roll again. They said to bring it up.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chair, I just want a clarification. This is on the actual bill.
This is on the bill. This is for passage as amended and referral to the general register. Yes. Yes for passing the bill. You flip over. If you're doing as instructed, you. Okay, call the roll.
Chairman Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Bingham.
Yes.
Representative Cornish. Representative De La Forest.
No.
Representative Emmer.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Yes.
Representative Hoberg.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Kalin.
Yes.
Representative Coles.
No.
Representative Kranz. Representative Lesh. Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Yes.
Representative Saylor.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Westrum.
It passes 9-6. The next bill is Word in the World, and Ansel's was just sitting there. And I saw, didn't Zellers come in tape?
Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid the speed at which you're moving scared him when he ran.
Representative, did you ever think you would say those words?
Mr. Chair, is this being laid over? Is this bill, is Zeller's bill like planning on laying this over? Or I'm thinking maybe I do want to take the heat and go ahead and present it. And he's mad at me, and oh well.
we can
take any testimony if there's opposition testimony to the bill.
Representative Holberg moves the moves the Zeller's bill for possible inclusion in our omnibus. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have an offers amendment.
Do we have that in there? We're getting lost in paper.
We're just on Congress committee, so
you personally probably had 20 of them.
Northern Minnesota paper and pulp industry is being served well tonight, Mr. Chairman.
Are you just trying to run out of time with amendments to the midnight hour?
No, this one's actually the amendment came from some of the discussions that we had.
Representative Sellers, does anybody have your amendment? Is this a little short thing that we ended up with?
It's a line in pigeon line. It's about 4 cents. No, I don't.
Is this the A1 amendment then?
Yeah. Pender.
Does anybody?
The bill.
Yeah.
The bill is in there.
211.
211.
No, the bill.
Oh, okay.
I'm
on
211, that one.
How many have the 201 amendment? Okay, it's being run off. Representative Zellers, we won't move it, but would you discuss?
I'll be happy to discuss.
Why don't you discuss the bill and the amendment as if it was on, because I assume we'll put it on to put it in the shape you want. So, Representative Zellers, do you know anybody? Is there opposition tonight?
I do not, it was earlier, but I don't know if they're,
the last bill she saw.
Yeah, apparently they're newbies, they haven't, they don't want any players down here.
They were afraid of the discussion between Representative Holberg and Representative Cotton. Representative Zollers, is 4 minutes enough then? Or you
no problem, Mr. Chairman. I will run through it very quickly. Actually, the article that you've, I think you actually do have this, it was just passed out, is pretty much explains the whole bill. This comes out of, this is truly constituent service. Not too long ago, during the drop in the housing rates, my wife and I refinanced our home. Within a few weeks, we got a number of letters in the mail, and being a junk mail enthusiast, my wife went through and read the actual junk mail, and found in the junk mail not only our address, a fake account number, but it said Wells Fargo account number, and then found the actual value of our home, and then what they believed was the remaining value or remaining mortgage payment. And then also included in the this wonderful gift letter was a home equity line for whatever the remainder or what they'd estimated that we had actually seen as an increase in evaluation of our home. So in one letter we have a wonderful rate, a home equity line, and they claim to know what we still owe on our mortgage. My wife actually did go check on the internet and looked, and they were within a few $100s of the actual value of our home. Needless to say, she was a little bit frightened by this. I went and looked it up, and come to find out it really wasn't true, but using actuarials and a little bit of math and a couple of computers, you can come up with a pretty close number, and that's what they've done here. So shortly after we presented this bill in Commerce Committee, the articles you have in front of you from the Star Tribune came out. I made copies for members. Since then, I've actually had a few folks come and talk to me. Somebody actually got a letter within the last week with a lot of the same materials, but the new caveat was that their credit score was included in the letter. So we've actually seen a number of these cases. This is just a consumer protection bill so that folks aren't, just because you want to go in and apply with your mortgage company to get a better rate, you're not going to get drowned in a number of offers, and offers that, quite frankly, will actually raise your monthly mortgage payment and cost you and your family money. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Zollers. Could you explain what the A1 amendment is? As I recall,
you know, I gave it to the page, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. It was the only copy I had.
Thank God. Representative Sellers, I thought that what I'm concerned is that there was a lot of negotiation went into this, and I know Representative Dabney was very concerned about things, and are we changing anything from when it left Commerce?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The A1 amendment... The article that you'll see, there's the triggers. So if, say I go in, refinance my mortgage with Wells Fargo, automatically that triggers with one of the bureaus. I had a mortgage broker come in and tell me he can sign up for $20,000 worth of services. So it's a UI, anybody in the committee refinances, that trigger automatically goes onto a list and then is sold to mortgage companies. So what we're doing in here is that the party is working with the mortgage. So in other words, your banker working with you on your refi or your new home, that's the party that's being included in here. So we're not changing the... I know Representative Dabney and some of your concerns were with the counties and what information the counties are providing. That does nothing to change it in there.
Since we're laying it over, we can talk to Representative Dabney. He was quite concerned that we stay with what came out of Commerce, but I'll talk in the meantime.
Certainly.
Ms. Cook, are you... You're moving forward. Okay. I didn't know you were going to.
Mr. Chairman, let me help you.
No other chairs. Oh, it hasn't been moved yet. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it has.
I'd be happy to move the A1 amendment.
Yeah, you got to wake up. we did the removal of bill, but you would have been right if you said the amendment.
Mr. Chair, did you move the A1?
Oh, he moved. So he was right. I got to wake up. Okay. The move. the A1 amendment is moved by together in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Okay, it's in the shape that you want, and you've given all your testimony. Is there anybody want to speak on it? Representative, I was just going to look the opponents first, and I just want... Is nobody speaking on it? Okay, Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers, thank you for bringing this forward. I support the bill. I like it. Maybe this is good for this year, but maybe next year we can work together on email versions of this, because that's where I'm getting a lot of this. So, anyway, so thank you for doing this, and maybe over the interim, Representative Dabney and you and I can get together and deal with the email versions of this stuff, too.
Thank you, Representative Bingham. I actually had one in here. I think it was maybe a victim of the Commerce Committee Tree Fest downstairs. I think I lost the email, but I have one from my mom. It was sent right to me at my House of Representatives account. So,
Representative Zellers, please bring your amendment to Representative Dabney so that we don't have anything happen in the meantime. And Representative Zellers, your bill is laid over for possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
And then Representative Anzo, you are up. That was laid over for the data practices bill. Part of it. Part of it was outside. Representative Anzals, I hope you stay longer than the last time we saw you.
Mr. Chairman and members, I apologize for a little confusion the last time I was in the chair.
And Mr. Chairman, sure it was all his fault.
We're getting up to our own.
Representative Paulberg, from what I heard, Representative Zellers was very busy down there producing amendments today.
They were near Representative Ashton's 43 amendments.
Yes, I'm recalling the bill that I laid over.
Okay.
So we don't have to go through any motions. We're back into the situation. I was just going to give you, in fact, I had given you a couple minutes to refresh our memory of what it's about. And I'm trying to recall, you had testified the last time, I believe. Okay. So, Representative Anzals, just a real quick summary of what it's about for people, and then we can go and open it up for the discussion period and amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is House File 611. It's about communication in the workplace, public sector, private sector, workplaces where collective bargaining agreements are in place, and workplaces where the mayor's shop is in place. We are here primarily because of the remedies section, which is subdivision 3. But before I go any further, if it would be at all possible, Mr. Chair, I would like to invite up with me Craig Johnson from the League of Cities, who has been working with me through all the twists and turns in the roads we've gone down here, and he has a short bit of information to provide to the committee.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of regretting this question, I'm still going to tread out on the thin ice here. When we saw this bill before, there were a number of author's amendments and other amendments to get the bill in which the shape the author wanted to discuss. So I'm wondering, are we doing that tonight, or
Representative Anzals, what we have now in front of us is the 611 that we came to us last time. And do you have any amendments to that? I think that's Representative Holberg's question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, that's precisely the reason why Mr. Johnson from the League of Cities has joined me here, and he has some information regarding possible amendments that the committee might wish to hear.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I can keep this very brief. Just to update the committee that since you last met, we have been working very diligently with folks from AFSCME that have been drafting this legislation. We do have language that they have agreed to amend that is basic, that is based off of the amendment that the League had prepared at earlier committees. If we had not finished it in time to get it drafted for your committee tonight, Mr. Chair, so we will be taking care of it as soon as we are able to get the amendment drafted. We'd be certainly happy to give a description if members want, or to talk to them on the side to tell them what we are looking at doing to the bill.
And question, Representative Ansos, I don't quite understand. Are you going to be making that an author's amendment to your bill, or is that an opposition amendment? I don't understand.
Mr. Chairman, what Mr. Johnson is referring to will be in the form of a friendly amendment at the next stop.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, what is the motion? What is the next stop?
I thought...
Local government.
Oh, it goes to... That's right.
That's right.
We had a long discussion about local government. I'm sorry to insult you by calling you
representative.
Thank you,
Mr.
Johnson.
So, Mr. Chair, very briefly, the League's concerns that I will not repeat that we testified to at the last meeting are specifically addressed in the amendment that we are working up with the folks from AFSCME, and that Representative Ann Sells has agreed to work to get onto the bill at that stop as soon as we have it drafted. It does not fix everything about the bill, obviously. Otherwise, we'd be very happy, and labor might not be as happy. But we are satisfied that we have corrected the major deficiencies that we saw in the bill from our perspective as a city organization, and very much appreciate the work that both the House and Senate authors and the labor organizations did to help us get that ready. We just don't have it ready in time for you tonight, Mr.
Well, Mr. Johnson and Representative Ansels, thank you. We just did that thing last Thursday so that you could get this worked out together.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, this is a question for Representative Ansels. You're working with the city. I know that the bill applies, for example, to the state of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota. Were they part of the stakeholder discussion in this upcoming author's amendment? What's their opinion? And it's not the legislature from the state.
Mr. Jordahl from the state, whether you were going to testify or...
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson is going to testify.
Sure. Oh, he did before.
Didn't he?
With your indulgence, we appreciate his being here.
Would you... do you want to do the question there before he speaks?
Well,
or?
To that point, I think it would be helpful to have some description of where they're headed, and if... I mean, we heard concerns from not only the local units of government, but we also heard from the Chamber of Commerce, the state, and so whether or not this amendment that we're working on, have they engaged the chamber as well? I mean, we're kind of getting to that, well, yeah, we're supposed to talk about the remedy, but we need to know if the remedy matches the crime, kind of.
Representative Holbrook, what I was going to try to do is, to be fair to them, give them a very short description of where each of their positions were, not 5 minutes each, but very short of the parties, so that we could do that, if that's okay with everybody.
Mr. Chair, and I certainly look forward to hearing this from local government as well.
Monday.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, to briefly describe the amendment that Representative Holbrook was asking about. And this occurred primarily yesterday afternoon. I think everyone in the room here was around while it was going on, but this amendment was primarily worked out between local government interests to address our concerns and AFSCME. I think the other testifiers can tell you what their involvement was, which was basically hearing updates of where we were at and drafting. But they were present while we were working on it. The concerns that were addressed in it, very briefly, Mr. Chair, are that you clarify in House File 611 the definition of communication to specifically mean pertaining to union activities, business, or labor organizing as provided under state or federal law. So when we talk about communication that's protected here, we're very specific that it's only the union-oriented communication, not all communication that employees would do. In subdivision 2, we add new language that we probably don't want to get into in depth, but it would clarify that employers can have reasonable rules concerning the quantity, content, and attachments to communications, and can set appropriate non-work times for review of the communication, and that they can discipline or discharge employees for violating those policies and other normal employee communication or personnel policies. It also says that, as Representative Ansel's amendment that was brought up at the last hearing, that if employees are represented by a collective bargaining agent, the rules would be worked out jointly between the employer and the collective bargaining agent. And in the remedy section, the amendment will essentially delete almost all of the remedy section. We'll leave it as a remedy would be pursued through applicable grievance procedures and would be limited to wages and benefits lost by the violation, period. There would be no further reference to civil actions. There would be no further reasonable attorney's fees or other costs compensated.
Representative Insults, you could have avoided. Do you want to give a very short statement, and then we'll take a very short statement from you? Like a minute or something.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be able to get back before you and testify. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations, and in that capacity, I also serve as the State Labor Negotiator, a position that I've held for the last 7 years, and I've been in labor relations for over 30 years. I'm here today to speak to you, Mr. Legislator, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee, is really what I would call the Chair of the Board on behalf of state employees. We have grave concerns about where this bill is moving, particularly in the area of state service. And while I am sensitive to some of the points that Mr. Anzalek has raised, I'd just like to share with you just in the early 1990s, when state computers first arrived on the horizon, we had limitations on what state employees could use our computers for. And I'd also like to share with you that we have a provision in 43A that covers all state employees, 50,000 state employees, that says no employee shall directly or indirectly, during hours of employment, solicit and receive funds for political services, purposes, membership in any political organization, this is during state time, or take part in any political activity. This has been part of our merit system, our civil service statute, since 1939. It's part of the original civil service law. And we have, the concerns that we have is the politics that's engaged in the workplace. And so we have developed a policy. I made 15 copies of it. And I'll leave it here for you if you want it. And we've developed a policy with our within our organization. And by the way, Phyllis Kahn authored the legislation back in 2001.
Did he say 1939?
The policy that was not subject to bargaining. Our policy says you can't use our systems for political activities, for fundraising, for campaigning, for union office, for union organizing, or soliciting for employees for membership in a union. What they can use it for is posting notices for meetings, communications regarding grievances and the grievance process, answering contract interpretation questions, and notifying members of unit determination results. This works for us. Our concern is the application that this has to the over 110 state units that we have with our 50,000 employees. And I ask you, at least get us out of this bill. And you're including the state in this. We have a plan in place. It works, and it works well. And we do not want to be part of this bill, and I ask that you take us out.
Mr. Larson, thank you. Mr. Dietrichs, would you come up and try to keep it a little shorter? Because 1 minute became four. Thank you, Mr. Dietrichs. And you're from the Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And I will keep this brief, particularly because I already addressed the remedy section last time we met. I just wanted to elaborate a little bit upon a comment I made at the last hearing about why the Chamber believes this is preempted by federal law. It's dictated from the United States Supreme Court case, which says that any activity that is actually or arguably subject to a Section 7 or Section 8 right of the National Labor Relations Act is courts and states must defer to the exclusive competence of the National Labor Relations Board. And moreover, the failure of the National Labor Relations Board to define legal significance under the Act of a particular activity does not give the states power to act. Mr. Chair, real briefly, I have a notice before me right here from the National Labor Relations Board on March 27th, 2 weeks from now. They're actually having a hearing where they're discussing whether or not email should be part of collective bargaining and whether or not unions should be allowed to have access to employers' emails, actually employees at their employers' email locations. This is important because lines 1.19 through 1.24 are specifically covered by Section 7 and Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act, and so that is why the Chamber believes that this, at least as it pertains to our members, is preempted by federal law.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Then we will go to the period. I believe the Representative De La Forest has three, and Representative Holbrook. Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
De La Forest.
I appreciate, real quick here, Mr. Chairman, I think this will help you and the committee. Representative Anzos has obviously been willing to work with interested parties, and so at least two of my amendments that deal with the remedy section may be rendered moot by the time the next committee is reached from what it sounds like. So I would just be interested in offering one amendment that I, in all seriousness, Representative Anzos would hope you would see as a friendly amendment, or at least wouldn't be opposed to. And then for Mr. Chairman, I'd move the A7 amendment.
So we'll set aside A4 and A5 then, and A7 is...
I would move A7, and I will not offer the other two tonight, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, Representative De La Forest, Representative...
And De La Forest, Mr. Chairman, real quick, I'd be willing to explain the amendment. Here's the issue, members, and here's what I want to avoid. In Subdivision 2 of the bill on the prohibited practices, it essentially says that you can't stop employees from receiving a workplace communication. And as we know, particularly under federal decisional law, Title 7 of the Civil Rights Act, and all sorts of federal decisions that come down every day, directives from the Department of Homeland Security, sometimes it is incumbent upon an employer to ensure that employees don't receive a workplace communication. If you want to quit hypothetical, suppose that you have a building steward at your school, and he gets on his computer in the afternoon and uses the union email to send a sexually harassing communication to a coworker down the hall. If the leadership of that building, the principal, for example, becomes aware of those communications, the school district now has an affirmative legal obligation pursuant to federal law to stop folks from receiving those communications. And while I understand that there may be somewhat of an answer to that in establishing email policies, it may not be that every single employer has got them. You got to remember the bill's got a very wide scope. More than that, as I said, federal law, the courts interpret it every day. So I am just seeking to avoid a situation where our school districts or our cities or our small businesses out there get put into an impossible situation. That's all I'm seeking to avoid.
Representative Anzels, do you have a comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative De La Forest, it is the email form of communication that is most certainly the form of communication that I am attempting to guarantee in this bill, because it is the form of communication that employees are complaining to employers about that is being snooped upon and is being infringed upon. It is precisely the email communication that is the problem here. Now, if you look in on the bill, in the bill, it is the development of written policies and rules jointly established by the employer and the employee that will take care of Representative De La Forest's problem. And that is the linchpin of this whole concept here, that this will be a subject of negotiation between the bargaining agent and the employer, and then we need to have these policies published and posted for everyone to read and to understand so that we avoid any conflicts and any problems. So I would oppose, with all due respect, Representative De La Forest's amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I have just a brief response. So, Representative Ansels, I noticed your bill is sweeping. It covers, it's Chapter 181, it covers our private employers. It's Chapter 179A, it covers public employers. Not every workplace has email policies. They should. That's a best human resources practice, but they don't. And they don't often think of everything. Remember, we're talking about maybe a mom-and-pop business with three employees and one or two computers. They may not have the legal knowledge to craft the right kind of email policies. More than that, not every employer has a collective bargaining agent with whom to negotiate reasonable workplace policies. Maybe they'll write their own. But again, I don't think that this is a hostile type of amendment. I simply seek to avoid putting the very people who are supposed to make the laws, with the very people who make the laws everyone else has to live under, I just don't want to put them into an impossible legal situation. Well, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. You stop an email communication, like my hypothetical stated a moment ago, and then they get an action brought against them under your bill, or vice versa. I'm just seeking to avoid that. I don't think that's unreasonable. I honestly don't.
Okay, then, everybody ready? Then all in favor of the De La Forest Amendment A7, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
The noes carry it. Representative Holberg has...
As long as this is going to local governments, we can probably stretch the issue relative to schools, districts being local government type. I'll withdraw the amendment here, see what gets worked up in the meantime, try to compromise to the public employees in both
countries. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Then, looks like we're ready to vote. All in favor of passage of House File 611 and it is be sent to local government. Say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
No.
Carries. Thank you. Thank you. The last bill is not, the author can't make it, so we are adjourned.